Good morning, everyone. Good morning. I had initially thought I would not be here at 9 to just open up. And I do appreciate colleagues in Parliament joining us. And of course, with that we lost to communications, it's always great to see you back. Honourable Kalako, and also Honourable Kwabasa from Appropriations, thank you very much for being here. I'd like to just indicate that I received the legal advice and that I was referring to, but I will address it and add it to the agenda. I'm just trying to think where it would be suitable. We'll put it in immediately after SIPC. Is that all right? I won't address it right now. Is everyone happy about that? So that is in terms of the adoption of the agenda. You will have received your transcripts of the colloquium. Is that clear? Right, thank you. I'd like to have someone propose the adoption of the agenda. Thanks, Honourable Williams, seconded by the Honourable Montash. And then on that note, we've got the minutes before us here of the 17th of August, which we could do. You'll recall that they were before you. But we had asked for amendments. Do you recall that? It has been accordingly amended, and that is why you adopted it with the amendments, and we just thought it advisable to give you a fresh set. Are you still perusing it on Paul MacPherson? Are you still perusing the minutes? Okay. Well, on that basis, we are putting the minutes again before you because we're not too sure if all of those amendments were captured. Can we have someone to propose the adoption of the minutes? Thanks, Honourable Williams, seconded by Honourable Grenoff. With respect to the apologies, I shall be stepping out for half an hour or so and maybe 40 minutes. And I would like the Honourable Williams to take the seat in my absence. I will be back here again, I hope, at 9:20 to 10. Before I let you take the chair, I'm asking the Honourable Montash to please join me as I leave. On that, I'm just waiting for you to take the chair. Is that in order? Right.
Okay, we can start now. Thank you. We can move now, to the briefing by the SIPC. If you could introduce your people, it would be great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. It's good to see you all once again. My team that I have this morning from the CIPC, and to my left is Ms. Fundi Maza. She is acting CFO of the CIPC. She will be assisting me with the presentation and taking us to the financials. to my right is Mr. Lungile Kwana. He's our head of SASB. He will also assist when it comes to the issue of questions and clarifications. Honorable Chairperson, before we start, I would just say I'd like to tender my apologies. I'm slaving under a bit of bronchitis. It's near the end, but I have a bit of cough. Please apologize for that. I'd also like to apologize for my acting CFO, so I should mention this, that her luggage got left in Johannesburg. So she unfortunately had to wear what she was wearing yesterday. So as women say, I must be apologize for her. Honourable members, we have a fairly lengthy presentation because it's including it's two presentations in one. It's the annual report as well as the first quarter, so I will try to get through it as quickly and efficiently as possible in terms of time and for questions to be asked on it. If we go to the first slide, which is the highlight of the 15-16 year, I will take you through some salient points and just highlight exactly what they are and where we are as an organization regarding those issues. The first highlight is that the other members will know that CIPC for the period of time was acted with a lot of labor instability and labor unrest. Pleased to say that in the last 17 months, we've had a pretty stable labor environment, organized labor and management, better relations, and a lot of consultation, negotiation which occur, and we see them as strategic partners in delivering our mandate. So I wanted to highlight for the 15-16 year. We also have received the highest number of company registrations in history. Last year we registered 317,000 new private companies. There is an upward trend. I think that even this year we will see more. It shows there's a lot of activity in the markets, but we judge ourselves of how efficiently we can register them, and I think that we've been doing quite well as far as our turnaround time and our service delivery in ensuring that those 317,000 new companies get registered as quickly as possible. One of our strategies that has been going for many, many years is what is called our innovation automation strategy, whereby we bring online every quarter various processes and various forms. And in the year to date, in terms of the 15-16 year, we had a lot of automation, the main reservation function, so much so that in terms of our new doing business reports as by World Bank, they will be mentioning that as one part of the strategic improvement as far as company registrations are concerned. We've also automated the audit appointments, so it makes it quicker for companies that require audits to have their appointments be done very, very quickly. As it goes, that we've improved a lot on our service delivery standards. Our service delivery standards is what is referred to as almost our turnaround times, and as you can see from the slide that are to follow, there has been a reduction in the time that we take to process and register many of our applications. As I said, our automation strategy is very important to us. We would like to bring people online because it's quicker for us to register and quicker for us to deal with their queries. So online services have certainly seen an improvement in both the company and intellectual property spaces, and we've seen a stable IT platform which enhances the experience of customers, enhances automation services, and therefore we see many of our clients utilizing the online services more than accessing us manually through paper. We also pride ourselves as an organization of being one that collaborates in government but also in the private sector, and one of the big collaborations that we did in the 15-16 year was in something called a Settled Suppliers Database. I'm sure many of the colleagues know about that, in that those who now want to access government services and tenders can go to a single portal. We have worked very closely with SARS under the guidance of National Treasury as three central partners, and basically we have launched that with the Minister of Finance during the course of the 15-16 year. As you know, that from the 1st April, it is now mandatory for all service providers to access that particular portal. We've also now brought on all four banks, base banks in the South African market, whereby other members will know that it is a collaboration effort that has been going for many, many years, starting with FNB. We ended off with Nedbank, where the Minister launched the Nedbank service, and basically all four banks are now on board where clients can access either their website or go into a branch and be able to register the company and also within a period of a day also receive their business accounts. So that is functioning really, really well, and we like to consolidate some of those efforts in adding more services to the banking collaboration going forward. We want to do a lot of work with hybrid processes. Hybrid is that when a person can apply online but they must still send us a piece of paper. We want to try and make it fully online in some of those services. So we've automated many of the hybrid processes. We've done lots in terms of indexing system, the back end for fast processing, and therefore month on month and quarter on quarter we continue to enhance in terms of our hybrid and automation. As the members will know that, and because this is within this portfolio committee, is that the DTI is dealing with the intellectual property policy. What is contained within that policy is some called substantive examination of patents. We as implementing agency are gearing up for that in the sense that we've now brought on board our first set of patent examiners, something that we're very, very proud of. We've got these youngsters running around CIPC involved in lots of training exercises, going on lots of training to our partners, for example, in the BRICS group, in order for us to capacitize them to deal with the massive patent examinations when we believe we'll come on board in 2018. So we've taken on our first of 20 examiners, and they are basically going through a very intense training program which started in the 15-16 year and will continue all the way into the 2017-18 year. The next slide is just an indication of how we've moved our clients because of the stability in our IT environment. It is not fully up to scratch, but it's more stable than it really was, and we need to do more work in far as area is concerned. But as you can see from that particular slide, is that there is a shift in the way that we process our documents. There is a shift in behavior of the clients for which we service because they see the value, as I said, in online transacting. So if you look at the 15-16 year compared to the previous years, there is definitely a movement upwards in the way that we process and in the way that we transact with our clients. Company registrations, 95% of all of them were done through online portals and online registrations. Director changes, gradual increase, we're probably in the 94-95% mark now in the current year. Trademark applications, because we launched our e-filing process, we're really way up in the 95% or more area, and we're going to add more functionality which we'll get to. Patent applications, design applications, and copyrights shows exactly the same trend as far as online transactions are concerned and the movement into. The following slide I will try to go through as quickly because it is just a breakdown of our APP and what we achieved as far as that is concerned, and the final percentage as audited by the audit schedule when we get to how the organization performed as a whole. So the first aspect of our APP contains a share of us in terms of the reduction in the average number of us to register companies. As you can see, as manual companies and manual registrations, you can see there has been an improvement as far as that is concerned. We've met our service delivery targets. We've done what we're supposed to do as far as that is concerned, and basically we see there is a lot of efficiency gains for our clients as far as our registration. Look at the issue of cooperatives. The reason why the cooperative and the actual achievement is very, very quick as far as the turnaround time is concerned is because we are seeing currently a reduction in the number of cooperative registrations coming in the market. I recently had a meeting with the Director General of the Small Business Ministry for us to discuss this because the cooperative incentive schemes and the cooperative aspect lies within that ministry, and therefore we want to do more as far as education and awareness is concerned to try and see what the impact is and why the numbers are being reduced for us to have elements of an increase as we've seen in the previous years regarding cooperative sessions. The next aspect is to deal with the issue of annual returns. As you know, on an annual basis, companies are required to renew the information. They are required to inform us of any changes in the information, and that is lodged to what is called an annual return. We did not meet our target, but this is a really hard target to meet because it is an external target in the sense that we can only educate, we can only have media campaigns and communication strategies around us, but at the end of the day, it is up to the company to lodge the annual return. So slightly off that target, we wanted a 55% receivable rate as far as annual returns are concerned. We received 52%, but we've just launched a massive media campaign within CIP. Some of the members might have seen some of our billboards or seen some of adverts in the national newspapers, encouraging people to lodge their returns, and basically we want to see an uptake as far as that compliance rate in terms of annual returns. The next one is the issue on trademarks. We year on year meet our deadline and meet our service delivery target as far as trademarks is concerned. There is nothing to change as far as that is concerned. We continue to have a stable environment. We can still continue to use our e-filing enhancement for clients to their trademarks through. As I said, there's a 95% or more uptake, and basically the targets have already been met as far as trademark applications are concerned. The next one is our education and awareness campaigns and commercialization aspects in the IT space and patent and designs. You can see that we've been extremely busy as far as that is concerned. We were quite conservative in our approach in the APP when we started off. We thought we were going to do 1 a quarter. We ended up doing a hell of a lot more than that because we see the need for us to go out and really spread the word out in terms of IP, especially in the area of patents and designs, And basically, we've done massive amounts of education awareness campaigns throughout the country. We've also rolled out new campaigns whereby we go to schools, and we call it the sustainable of IP and commercialization aspects of intellectual property, whereby we take down to lower levels. We talk to school children, we talk to universities, and basically we're very active in this space, and many, many campaigns have been held over 15, 16 years. When it comes to the issue of patents, you will know that we are just a repository system in patents. It means that the turnaround time will always be stable as far as the receipt of those patents are concerned. Our service delivery target has been met in this area. The same for designs, exactly the same. It's a lodgement and it's a quality system, so it's also really quite easy for us to maintain and to go forward, receive those applications via this particular portals. When it comes to the issue of instant knowledge in the creative space, now the patent space now, there is a massive amount of work we've done, in, for example, in the indigenous knowledge system area, because we are also responsible for that. There are a call for many interventions in this area. That's the reason why we go out. Our previous deputy minister took a keen interest also in the creativity space, so we used to go out a lot and speak on this area. We used to accompany him as an organization to deal with the education and communication aspect of creativity and the creative industries. Same thing with Fulham. We saw a bit of an increase in the amount of Fulham applications we received, but pretty stable as far as how we process them and how we receive them. The one area that we did not meet, the next one, is that when it comes to the issue of the filling of our vacancies and the filling of our structure, you will see that we try to have a 75% full structure. We only have 74%, but this is a fluctuating target because we have a lot of people who resign for the organization. We have people who retire. We've got many quite elderly people who exit the organization. But we've also brought in new blood in terms of trademark examiners and patent examiners. And as we deal with the issue of critical vacancies, as you know that we had a moratorium, we still have a moratorium in the organization, but we negotiate and consult with organized labor to lift this moratorium in the critical area space so that we can have capacity gain. We slightly missed the target by a cent, but we will see the gains going forward. But the one thing that I should mention, the honorable members, is that we call the CIPC as a very enhanced automation and innovation strategy. We also need to take that into account as part of our change management process are concerned. We just don't want to fill the lumps for the sake of filling the lumps when we're automating many of the processes. So we have to balance it. We have to look at exactly what best the numbers is for the organization and see how best we can deal with the automation strategy linked to the filling of vacancies. So we don't do it in a piecemeal fashion. The next aspect is the issue of our stakeholder value index. There was an issue around us finalizing the survey for the year. We failed to finalize it. It is part of what we did not achieve. We have now awarded the particular tender to a company who will assist us with this particular stakeholder index, and we see that being fulfilled in the 16-17 year. So as far as the achievements is concerned regarding the organization, we met 82% of what we set out to do in the 15-16 year. It is an improvement on the following year. The three areas that we just slightly did not achieve on was annual returns. As I've explained, it is very much external. We have to receive them from the companies. We can only do so much as far as media campaigns and communication campaigns concerned. We did not fully capacitize our structure by percentage. As I said, there's movement regarding exits and entries. And the one that we did not achieve is the issue of the stakeholder index. 80% is the target for the 15-16 year. In terms of the breakdown of the various areas, the first I will start off with is company registration. That is what we own for mainly. Not all that we do, but we certainly measure a lot by what we do in this particular space. As I said, there is a 34% increase in
sight. Just a moment. We're a little bit lost. Where are these slides? This one,
the presentation has not changed, Honorable Chairperson. It is what was submitted last week.
Yeah, we have got those slides. Those slides there.
We will check the presentation. Correct,
members. So if you can just hold on a moment.
We certainly will. As I said, Honorable Chair, this presentation has not changed since last week. We submitted it to Parliament last week. I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday.
Has everybody got? Just give to all the members, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. As I say, the next slide is just a breakdown of the various areas that were contained in the previous slides, so that we can see exactly what the performance of the organization has been. As I said, company registrations have increased drastically by 34%, 15-16 here. As you can see, the previous year we did 236,000, now we've done 317,000. There's certainly a lot of movement to the market as far as this is concerned. We have enhanced automation, we've got various channels for access. We don't only have it on the website, we have partners where people can enter, we have banks. So we certainly see that there's an increase because we're making it easier as an organization for people and customers to transact with us. Cooperatives, even though we do a lot of work in this area to try and acclimatize and educate and communicate, we see year-on-year a reduction in the number. So much so that we've done only 30,000 in the 15-16 year. We need to do more. We need to understand why there is a reduction. We do know that when there was an incentive scheme, we saw a massive increase in the number of co-offices, especially coming from the provinces, because there was a lot of drive from provinces to have co-ops as part of the vehicles and the business vehicle. Those incentive schemes are not applicable anymore, and therefore we see the reduction going forward. We need to understand what it is. We need to understand why there's a 32% reduction. And as I said, we just process them. We post them as efficiently as we can. There's a very quick turnaround time as far as cooperative registrations are concerned. We do them possibly within a day or two at max, and basically we get them out as soon as we receive them. There's a few slides on trademarks. We did not only do the largest number of company registrations in the 15-16 year, we also did the most amount of trademark applications that we receive the most amount in the calendar year. Trademarks is a bit strange because we measure calendar year and we measure financial year. But in terms of the calendar year, we certainly receive the highest number that we've ever received in the office in the region of 37,000 new trademark applications. If you can see the trend on the year-on-year, you will see that there is an increase when it comes to this. There's a lot of work that we do as far as educating in any area is concerned, but it also is an indication of the market activity and certainly a brand reputation and brand building activity when it comes to trademark registrations. When you see the issue of how we register from application, as I said, we've now put on new trademark examiners. The period for which we examine trademarks has been reduced from between 12 and 13 months to between 10 and 11 months. We want to bring it down all the way down to 9 months. And with the new blood we have in the organization and the increase in the number of examiners that we have, we certainly see that movement month on month as far as our numbers are concerned and the number of registrations we do in the trademark area. This slide is just information sharing between who submits applications to us, residents versus non-residents. It happened a few portfolio committees ago, a couple of years ago, we were asked for the breakdown, so that's the reason why we include this particular slide to see if there is activity as far as residents are concerned, because there was a concern that states that we were receiving more applications from abroad than we were receiving from South African citizens, but you can see that the numbers are certainly stable and certainly on the increase as far as residents are concerned. When we look at patents and design applications, as I said, we are a depository system. We don't have substantive examination of patents as yet. We've seen a slight decrease, but not a very significant decrease in the number of patents that have been submitted from 2014-15 to 2015-16. As I said, our main focus is to get them out as quickly as possible. We simply do administration in terms of the acts. As far as patent and design is concerned, we don't actively examine them. We look for compliance as far as administration is concerned, and our turnaround time is certainly very, very stable and very, very quick. We do them in between 2 and 3 days. Copyright influence. As you know, that South Africa, in terms of common law, is that copyright is not fully regulated in terms of registrations. We only register films. There is a stable number of them. We don't register many, many, many of them. Even though we're very active in the market as far as speaking to creative bodies, we go out and speak to many creative bodies. We deal with issues regarding the registration process, how easy to register, because we have an online portal, but we certainly do not have vast numbers in the copyright influence applications. As you see, year on year, it's pretty much between 60 and 80 applications. that we certainly are extremely active in. It's a business rescue area. We seem to be building a lot of capacity and expertise in this area. We have a lot of functions and functionaries that deal not only with the administration but also the education as well as the licensing of business rescue practitioners are concerned. In the 15-16 year, there was an increase in the number of applications. Our aspect is to deal with the application and get them out within 2 days, or to register and license a new business practitioner within 5 days, and we certainly have met all those targets. Also, what we do, and something that we've taken on, and we started in the 15-16 year, is to create a forum for business rescue players, if I can use that word. When I say players, I mean along the value chain of business rescue, there are certainly aspects of banks, there's aspects of academics, there's aspects of the DTI, which is our partner, and there's aspects of provisional bodies which supply cater of business rescue practitioners. So we have created a forum within the CIPC. We've had about 3 to 4 meetings. We've had tons of references being developed. So it's certainly to bring all players together to understand what's the blockages in business rescue we wanted certainly to function and wanted to work, as also to deal with aspects of how do we increase the knowledge and certainly how do we increase the number and the capacity of business rescue practitioners that are entering the market. We are seeing the same names cropping up on applications. We have possibly about 230 business rescue practitioners. We want that to grow, and therefore we see ourselves as playing an intermediary role from the CIPC as far as that is concerned. Also, honorable members, you will know that after 5 years of application in terms of the Companies Act, the DTI is going through a review, a 5-year review of the legislation. A lot of commentary is in the business rescue space, so we use these forums in order for us to see how best that we can try and deal with amendments to the Act, proposals that we want to put forward as far as making it better in terms of the legislation that we hear from practitioners, that we hear from academics, and we hear from the banks who play a lot of a significant role as far as the financing of business rescue, and if we want to see how best it works. So we play that role, and basically we liaise quite closely with the DGI as far as that is concerned. CIPC is not only an administrator of company law, we also a regulator of company law, and therefore we play a massive role in the investigation phase, investigating companies. Month on month we see various complaints, not only from various company shareholders, directors, but we also work closely with a body called the Companies Tribunal to deal with investigations that flow from that particular body. We see it as part of our dual role, and basically we have a fully fledged enforcement wing that goes out and deals with these areas and has a successful impact and input in the area. So much so, honorable chair, honorable members, is that in the last few months we've had our first successful criminal conviction of a director of a company. The company failed to lodge financials. There was complaints. Took the matter all the way to court, and there was a successful conviction of a particular director in a very, very large company. We've now published it on our website. We're also going to publish it on the SENS in the Johannesburg Security Check, because it's in the listed environments. So we see our regulatory role increasing and us getting more involved and having more teeth, as it were, in order for us to deal with violations in the company space. Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, I will hand over to the CFO to deal with the financial aspects of the 15-16 year, and then we call Honourable to deal with the first quarter. Thank you very much.
Thank you, my acting Commissioner. Thank you, Chair Philip, and good morning to you, Chair President, and to the committee members. My job is much simpler than my boss, I must say. What I'd like to take the House through is actually the financial performance for the financial year that ended March 2016. Chairperson, I'd like to start it actually with our audit report for 2015-16 year, and looking at that and actually analyzing a trend from March 2014 to where we were in March 2016. Decided to analyze the audit report in 3 phases. We look at the impact on the aging opinion and the financial statements, we look at compliance with laws and regulations, we also look at the opinion of the AG in terms of our performance and commission. On the financial statements, I must say that we've maintained the same opinion as the previous financial year. The AG did not have any significant issues, therefore we got an unqualified audit opinion on the financial statements, which is more or less consistent with March 2015 and an improvement when compared to March 2014. Looking at the other section that is in the AG's report with regards to their compliance with laws and regulations, where the AG will not comment in terms of the areas which were significant weaknesses in our internal control, that could have led to us having findings that were noting on the audit report. In that particular area, Chair, we sort of regressed this in as far as the fact that for March 2016, the AG is of the view that as management, we did not implement adequate steps to prevent irregular expenditure. Chair, that relates to the irregular expenditure on implementation and interpretation challenges that we had in terms of implementing our annual increment for 2016 financial year. And I think those were based on the final phases of the transition process. If you can remember that we were still in the process of transitioning from CIPO into the CIPC, and as a result, we sort of had also make sure that our salary structure also is, for our officials is changed from being a basic package into your cost to company based package. I mean, into cost to company structure. So we had a couple of interpretation challenges there, so that resulted in us having a sort of an irregular expenditure. I'm also pleased to announce that when it comes to our performance information, for the very first time in many, many years, we have been able to come out where the AG expressed an unqualified opinion compared to the previous years, which have lost count, whereby the AG was expressing a disclaimer on our performance information, stating that in the past they were unable to really comment on the validity and reliability of our performance information. So, it's quite a significant improvement for us with launching on the performance information. So those are just, that's just a high-level summary in terms of our AGI report for the 2016. Moving on to the financial statement, I'd like to start with the statement of financial position. It's normally also referred to as the balance sheet or the financial health or facts of an entity. You'll find that on page 91 of our annual report at high level. Here we're looking at our non-current assets. Those we normally refer to as fixed assets in normal terms. Nothing significant happened in the 2016 financial year. If we compare to the March 2015, there was a 9% decrease, purely because we really did not have significant additions on that. Looking at our current assets, those are short-term assets. But for CIPC purposes, with a balance of 1,598,000,000 of current assets that we had in March 2015, 99.9% of that consists of our cash and cash equivalents. Overall, nothing hectic on total assets for the year because there was 1% increase when compared to March 2015 from 1,617,000,000 to 1,637,000,000. So looking at the liabilities, which will then give us the health, which is the net asset of the CIP. Liabilities have increased by from 1,117,000,000 to about 1,031,000,000, a 30% increase if you compare the two financial years. Nothing hectic, basically you're increasing your provision for bonuses, increasing your provision your subcost actually, and your leave as well. In terms of our overall health, we are still very much liquid and solvent. Our net asset value has moved or increased from 1,500,000,000 to million to 1,505,000,000. Overall, it's quite consistent. So I'd like to move over to the financial performance. In normal terms, it's also normally referred to as your income statement or your statement of income and expenditure. Total income for the year, we've seen an 8% growth in our revenue figures from 5.8 million to 5.7 million. We've also seen a 15% increase in our expenditure from 306 million to 351 million. That's operational expenditure. And I think further details are reflected on page 92 of our annual report. And in terms of the surplus for the year, there's a slight decline there. because you can see the inconsistency in the increase in income vis-a-vis the inconsistency when compared to the increase in the expenditure, whereby the income increased only by 8% and expenditure increased by 15%. So therefore, overall, that's a negative decrease in the surplus for the year from 201 million in March 2015 to 196 million in March 2016. The next slide share what basically does is we're looking at our actual figures compared to what was our approved budget for the same financial year, which is March 2016. Here I'm going to focus just on the total figures, if that is okay with the house. The details of this particular slide as well are reflected on page 95 to page 96 of the annual report, whereby page 96 goes into details in terms of explanations for the significant variances when we compare our actual performance to our budgeted or approved budget for the year. In terms of total income for the year, 547 million was our actual performance, and we budgeted for 508 million share. That translated to about an 8% improvement of performance when compared to what we had budgeted for. And then significant contribution to that is the interest income, obviously because of the increase in our revenue figures, as well as the increase in the revenue or overperformance in the revenue. Looking at the expenditure items, overall in terms of the total expenditure, what was approved, this is only operational expenditure. What was approved to pay our budget was 411 million, and our actual performance was slightly below that, 14% below the approved budget, which was now 351 million. The main contributor for the 14% cost saving, if you can call it that way, it's the overheating expenditure and the admin expenditure, which both were 29 and 35% respectively, below budget. So in terms of highlights, it's highlighted at a high level. The reasons for the 29% and the 35% below budget spending, if you look at operating and admin expenditure, is we had quite significant savings in terms of the cost that we incurred when we established our SLPs, our self-service terminals, throughout the country. Initially, we had budgeted for costs whereby we'll set up our own offices, but we ended up establishing that through collaboration initiatives that we had with other government entities, so we had significant cost savings in terms of establishing costs, as well as our education and meet and awareness campaign that only commenced in the current financial year. In terms of revenue trend, if you look at the 3-year history, our focus on revenue, in the 2014 year we're at 379 million and we've grown to about 438 million over a 3-year period. That's about a 16% increase. Here the other, maybe let me address it in order to just make sure I may also just address questions as well. What sits in the item that we call as other is our prescription of unidentified funds. So what we do is that we normally don't budget for that because we're not sure how much our clients will utilize or be able to identify or claim back through the financial year. So we just normally reflect that separately. But what we do is wherever a client can prove that such funds belong to them and positively give us proof, we normally refund those in terms of our policy. And I think done well as well in terms of our interest income. In 2014, we're at 67 million. In 2016, 3 years later, we're at 103 million, which is about a 54% increase or growth. High level operational expenditure compared by a 3-year period. Employee costs, we're sitting at 186 million in the 2014 financial year. That has grown to about 231 million in 2016 financial year, which is translated to about 24%. I think that is likely to be expected because of the changes and the transition that we've been going through as an organization. Overall, in terms of the total expenditure, it has grown by 14% from 309 in 2014 to 351 million in the 2016 financial year. Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to hand over to my acting commissioner because to take us through the quarter one performance information.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Thank you, Funti, for that. Honourable members, I'll take you to the quarter one performance. As I said, it's inclusive in terms of our presentation this morning. In terms of our targets, for the first quarter, we have met 90% of our targets. 14 of the 15, as per the APP, has been met. There was underperformance in the one area, which was a significant one, which is the average number of days registered a company from the receipt of the application. We had a bit of an outage in the first quarter, where we had this failure of our IT system. We managed to bring it up after possibly about 2 to 3 days, but it lasted longer in terms of about 2 to 3 weeks, as far as to stabilize on that particular environment, whereby our performance dipped in terms of that particular quarter. However, we are in the process of looking at new hardware in the CIPC. We are going to be putting out a tender for additional service. We're also going to be looking at enhancing our databases, and we're also looking at something called Future View, whereby we may want to, as an organization, be. It's going to be a big focus for us in the 16-17 year as far as our IT spend and our IT capacity and capability is concerned, and therefore we want to enhance and strengthen that because we see ourselves as being extremely reliant on the stability of our system. Be that as it may, after the outage, we managed to bring it back in terms of some of the areas and the turnaround time and service delivery standards. We thereafter continue to meet our target in terms of company and cooperative registration being 2 work days on the receipt of an application, and basically being where we are now, we are doing registrations in the company phase in the standard day. It shows the stability that has been built as well as the enhancement and performance of the service. When it comes to the issue of annual returns, we've seen a slight increase. I think some of our media campaigns and our education campaigns are bearing fruit. Also, we are undertaking a deregistration process. We went through it in the last couple of weeks. When we see deregistration occurring, we see also an increase in the number of annual return files. So it could be part of why we're seeing that and why we're meeting our particular targets. As I said, we collaborate with many government departments. I won't even mention the DTI because on a weekly basis we are out with them taking DTI to the people. We form part of the core group, but we've now also managed to establish a partnership with the Department of Small Business. They're part of the campus, and we basically piggyback on their education campaigns, and we go out and spread the CIPC word regarding registrations as well as IP. As I said, we have an outreach, but we continue to build on the stability in our IT system. Of the target, which is 95%, we reached 97% of our e-service application, which is our core application, which is basically how a large number of applicants enter the system, and we see that as part of our ease of access for registration, and we see our that portal functioning quite efficiently in the first quarter. Something that we are pushing very, very hard in this particular, in the first quarter and for the rest of the year, is the rollout of our self-service technology, as many of the members are aware of and many of the members have seen, but we are now enhancing on it, and we're basically taking it to the next level, whereby we want to place it and the technology, we want to place the technology in the offices of what we call our intermediaries. A pilot is running, and a pilot is out of the way. We've seen some good results as far as that's concerned, with biometrics and enhanced verification, together with the collaboration with the Department of Home Affairs, and we want to see a full rollout towards the end of September, beginning of October. But I'll speak about that pilot going forward in an additional slide. I did mention in previous slides that we launched the NetBank collaboration. It seems to be functioning quite well. There is certainly an uptake. We need to do more as far as the two entities are concerned, NetBank and CIPC, in order for us to deal with the media and communication campaigns. Certainly stable, and we're certainly seeing a month-to-month uptake as far as that is concerned. There's an enhancement of our e-services, as I said, in our core application. We continue to build dashboards, continue to build functionality on the e-services, and for us to make it easier for people to access us, as well as for the turnaround times, the service delivery standards will be enhanced as far as that portal is concerned. The big complaints we had over a long period of time was that a person would transact with us, they will apply for a password and a username, they will only come back a year later and they forget it, and therefore they find it difficult in order to access it. We've now simplified password reset components. We've put it out on our USSDs, put it out on our website, and basically we see that functionality now being used more in terms of our clients being able to change the passwords and to contact with us. As you you all know, honourable members, is that the president launched InvestSA collaboration, the inter-ministerial commission was set up. The pilot of the InvestSA collaboration and the office will be in the CIPC. We are working very hard with the DCI in order to get all the relevant departments in-house. We're starting our remodeling of our office and our ground floor in order to house InvestSA, and CIPC sees it as part of the role it needs to play as far as achieving what needs to be achieved as far as the committee is concerned, and what the president has set out to achieve as far as InvestSA, making it easier for those who come from abroad to deal with the regulations and the registration in South African environments. I did mention briefly that we also, as CIPC, started engaging the World Bank. You know that the World Bank on an annual basis puts out a doing business report. We have taken on the role to try and coordinate some aspects of that particular report, especially in the starting of a business indicator. We've had numerous meetings with the World Bank. We have taken them through what we have done as an entity. We have taken them through the enhancement that we are going to put in place in the coming year. Basically, we are trying to form a closer relationship with the World Bank in order for us to improve on our ranking going forward. In the previous years, in the doing business report, information was simply sent to various departments. It was dealt with, but in a coordinated fashion. Now we see this as part of the government's strategy going forward to coordinate these efforts and try to build on our ranking. Action number 7, we're dealing with something called the indexing system. The indexing system is that when an applicant files a piece of paper with us through our online portal, previously what it means is that a staff member will have to open that particular document and check the information in and verify the information and index it into the registration system. In the last few months, we have now automated the system. It makes it easier for registrations to occur. It makes it quicker for registrations to occur. And it also reduces the number of errors. So we see a further enhancement as far as that is concerned. We also hosted a very successful World IP Day. As I said, we are now trying to take the message of IP down to school children. We included them in the campaign. We had thousands and thousands of children at the launch where we held at the Sibono Discovery Center in Johannesburg. We invited many schools, many of them pitched up, and 2 days we basically spoke about intellectual property and what it means for them to inculcate within them exactly how to move forward, to understand. Many of them didn't understand what intellectual property is, and we continue to roll out this program, not only to schools but also into universities and speaking to them. As I said, we continue to enhance the pace of the training interventions. We got a lot of help from our partners abroad. We also deal with online training for our examiners. Our 20 are seriously intending this particular exercise. They are very young people. Many of them have these marvelous degrees and PhDs in chemistry and mining and engineering. And we're going to see them put to good use as far as the examination training as well as the rollout of extensive examinations is concerned. As I said, our accessibility not only is online or paper, but we have multiple avenues for them to access and continue to build on that. We have the banks. We're rolling out a third-party model. We have self-service terminals, which are collaboration with Home Affairs, because we also believe in enhanced verification of those who access our systems. That is the reason why we use the harness system. And we're also very much dealing with partner organizations, which I will speak about going forward, in terms of rolling out our entities in the provinces, which I'm very passionate about. A big focus for us this year, because we see the value of it, is taking our technology for self-service terminals and placing it in the hands of third parties. It extends our footprint. We deal with less paper because it is done in back-end engines and business engines which run in the back-end in order to verify and in order to register. There's more security because biometrics will be done from the point of entry in a person's office. We also see it being very valuable in that we do not have errors being placed in the registration system, and we also see enhanced verification being done. We also rolled out to various government departments and provincial partners, and we see that as part of pilot being concluded and a full rollout taking place in the next month. Today we've registered about 17 third-party organizations in order to deal with the pilot. We see good uptake. We see really, really speedy registrations. We have been registrations being done in a matter of minutes because of this particular announcement. And if we will continue to roll it out and make sure that we have campaigns for more people sign up for it and more enhancements are being done to it in order for us to improve on that particular area. As you can see, the stats in the pilot are very encouraging as far as the youth. We only got 17 across the country, but the numbers certainly, and the speed of registration is certainly encouraging when I look at it on a weekly basis. When it comes to the issue of education awareness, we've also now are collaborating and being in a partnership with South African Breweries. South African Breweries has this very big truck that goes out into the provinces that deals with entrepreneurship, business planning, and all of that. We piggyback on that. We teach whoever arrives, customers and clients, about registrations, and we certainly go the length of South Africa in order to spread the message about registration, as well as how to deal with businesses, how to deal with compliance and regulation, and basically how to run a private company. Our focus is very much on youth and entrepreneurs, and basically to teach them how to use our systems, as well as to teach them about the company law and how to be compliant when they do enter the market and they do enter formal registration processes. As I said, a very big focus that I want to do in this financial year is to make sure that we have partners in every single province. I will not speak about the partners that currently have. We have them in Durban, we have them in London, we have them in the Western Cape. I'm going to talk about new partners that we're going to be engaging with, some of them that we already started with, but we want to have this presence throughout every province before the end of the financial year. So our rollout of our self-services knowledge to other provinces includes the Northern Cape. We've established a partnership with the Northern Cape Economic Development Department. Kimberley has been rolled out, Kimberley has been established. And anybody who wants to register a company and wants to find out information and needs some assistance to register, then walk into the Economic Development Department where they'll find a self-service terminal and be able to be assisted, what we call assisted self-service, in terms of that area. As it anticipate, we set up, we're ready to go in Ndansani. We're just waiting for the launch to happen. The terminals have been placed. The terminals are up and running. The connectivity has been sorted out. And basically, we have a presence in the area. Limpopo, we're dealing with Transnet, which is one of our big partners. What's called a Tabasi hub in Transnet is currently under construction. This is completed. We have signed an MOU basically to place our terminals there and form part of that area. So we'll have a presence in the Limpopo area as well as a presence in the Polokwane area, because we've also got an agreement and an MOU which is being completed with the Limpopo Enterprise Development Agency. In the States, in Bloemfontein, we've got a collaborative with the Free State Development Corporation. We completed the MOU, and basically we're ready to deploy and take our self-service technology to Free States and any other areas that want it. Our next steps, as I said in the rollout, we're looking and currently in discussions with the Rustenburg area, looking at a college, and what was the rollout there, and we're looking at Mpumalanga so that we have a footprint throughout the country. We all know that we also entered into partnerships with the BEE Commission to roll out BEE certificates. I'm pleased to say that since we rolled it out, we had 53,000 BEE certificates being dispatched through our terminals, and we see a month-on-month increase as far as that is concerned. We also would like to increase some of the functionality into the third-party area, and therefore we are in discussion currently with the BEE Commission in order for us to have a collaborative effort as far as including that as part of that process. As far as enhanced automation and digitalization of services is concerned, we will be starting a process in trademarks in order for us to enhance on the renewal process of trademarks, as well as to deal with the issue of online filing, as well as deal with the issue of company registrations and its increase of volumes and numbers. I'll hand over to Fundi. You with the question.
Thank you, Acting Commissioner. Looking at our financial performance for the first quarter of 2016-17, I thought it might be worth it to just take the house through the
annual. Just to make sure we've got you on track here, Ms. Malani. Malaba.
Yes, ma'am.
Right. Remember, if we ever wanted a transcript, we'd need to know what your name is, and the person transcribing may not be sitting in this room. Thanks.
Thank you. Saying that in order to be able for us to look at the performance for the third quarter of 2016-17, we thought it would be prudent to just also indicate to the House just the overall annual budget for the year, but also looking at over a three-year period in terms of how our annual budget, the CIPC, has moved over the past 3 years from 2014 to 2016.
So if you look at the income, in terms of the annual budgeted figures only, we've moved from 4.8 million in terms of budgeted income to about 520 million. In terms of the budgeted expenditure, we've moved from about, in 2014, 411 million to 560 million in 2017. I think the figure for 2015-16 is 425 million for the expenditure. I see there was a typo on the slide. If we're looking at our annual budget compared to the actual quarterly spending, what the slide is indicating to the house is basically looking at 100% budget as ABC, but how much of that have we spent for the first quarter? If you look at the budget for 2016-17, I think in terms of the total budget, we've only spent 15% of our annual budget, and therefore we still have about 85% remaining. If you look at the split in terms of expending, out of the 15% of our annual budget, which was reflected on the previous slide of 560 million for the 2017 financial year, if you look at how far or how much we have spent for the first quarter, for operational expenditure, we spent about 15% of that. So for the remaining financial year, we still have to spend about 85% for operational expenditure. For CAPEX expenditure for the first quarter, we spent about 2% of the annual budget. So we still have about 98% in terms of CAPEX plans that we need to implement before the financial year. So for the period of July to March 2017. Looking at much more detail, but still at high level, in terms of our actual performance for quarter one, and also compared to the actual performance for quarter one in the 2015 financial year. In terms of our revenue figures, we generally don't have problems in that area because we tend to overperform and apply to ourselves most of the time. In terms of direct revenue, we had, in terms of the prorated figure, which is your prorated budget April to June 2016, we had anticipated that we would have collected 107 million. We actually collected 118 million, which is 10% above what we had anticipated, and that is also an improvement compared to the previous financial year, because in June 2015, we actually had only exceeded our expectations by 4%. I will not go into the other row for your other income, that's your land income. Interest, that's basically linked to our cash reserve. We anticipated that we have earned about 22 million for the first quarter. We've actually earned about 29 million on the reserve that we have. And that's about 31% above what we had anticipated. Overall, in terms of total income, we had anticipated that we would have collected and earned 130 million for the first quarter. We've actually earned and collected, in terms of revenue, 147 million. So we 13% above what we had targeted for. Looking at the expenditure, employee cost, we are 26% below what we had anticipated cash spend for the first quarter. And looking at the figures, that is comparing 77.9 million versus the 58 million which was budgeted. That gives us a variance or an underspending of 26%. I think that is mainly due to delays that we have in terms of appointments and also some of the challenges that we experience now and then in terms of the moratorium that I think my acting commissioner has touched on. And that sort of affects our spending behavior when it comes to personnel cost. Operating expenditure, that's about 23% below budget. That is still much better compared to the same period in previous financial year, which was about 57% below budget. So with admin expenditure, we have operational delays, which is normally happens in the first quarter, where they're 8% below budget, but it's still much better compared to the same period in the previous financial year, where we're 412% below budget. Looking at the total expenditure overall, we're 25% for the first quarter below budget, which we are quite comfortable that we should be able to align with our budget in the remaining quarters of the financial year. Just looking in terms of where do we make our money, in terms of income or direct revenue, this is excluding your, this is our operational revenue, excluding your interest and any other sundry income. Overall, if you look at the total column, comparing the first quarter of 2016, comparing that to the first quarter of the previous financial year, generally we had about a 7% increase in our direct revenue. the driving factors behind that is normally your annual returns, and can see that has improved to 71 million. In 2015, same period, you know, to about 79 million in 2016. So making quite a whole lot from annual returns, followed obviously by our patents and trademarks, and struggling a bit in co-op, as the commissioner, as the acting commissioner has highlighted when he was presenting the performance information. In terms of operational expenditure, as comparing the current quarter for April to June 2016 compared to the same period in the previous financial year, in terms of the total expenditure, it's decreased slightly by 6%, which I think is still below 10%, should say that is acceptable. In terms of employee costs, we've seen an increase or variance of about 5% in the actual expenditure, so actual for 2015 compared to the actual for 2016, which is more or less acceptable. And then operating expenditure and admin expenditure, I think those have been very much inconsistent due to changes in our operational plans. Looking at our capital expenditure, there is a slight improvement when you compare the two quarters for the current year compared to the same quarter in the previous financial year. But overall, there is still a lot of struggle when it comes to our capex budget. In total, we are 25% below budget for the first quarter. This will be 90% when you compare the same quarter in the previous financial year. I must say that a significant portion of our CapEx expenditure relates mainly to ICT spending, which is either your hardware or software. And as the house is aware that you are very much a technologically or driven organization. But at the same time as well, when it comes to the requirement of ICT, also, based on our history at IPC, we tend to be extremely cautious and we tend to have also complex programming processes as well that we have for ICT. But we're quite confident that before the end of the financial year, we would have been able to put into place the technology that we require at IPC. I will hand over. Oh, okay, I think we're done. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Fundi, and thank you very much, Chairperson and honourable members. That's it from us as far as the presentation is concerned. We are available for any questions, clarifications. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Foller. Advocate Foller. That's right, Advocate Foller. Certainly, maybe acting commissioner, but it's also advocate. And you seem to have brought Mr. Dukwala along as well. Is that right? Head of strategy. Thank you very much, both of you. If we can turn to the committee then, Honourable Esterhazen, Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Williams, Honourable Nkongi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Acting Commissioner started off to say that like the environment is stabilised now. It's not a concern that it's an Acting Commissioner Acting CFO, I think the Chief Financial Officer was also suspended or something a while ago. And how long does it take to before these positions become permanent? And how does it affect the situation, the financial situation in the CPI, CIPC, and the effectiveness of doing business, of course? Because there was already concerns that the turnover time took much too long in the CIPC, and it, of course that affected or had huge financial implications to companies and businesses. Also mentioned the increase on the highlights, increase of online services, because before there was huge problems in the online services from the CIPC, up to 12 months waiting list, which was completely unacceptable for company registration and transactions online, and of course the financial implications that went with it. Also, the allocation of funds to companies took months. With so many applications and queries that you mentioned, Acting Commissioner, a record for that happened now. How does this stop complications? Because I believe there was also a complete strike at the CPI, CIPC offices. How did that affect your daily running? People wanted the previous commissioner out or something, if I remember correctly. If I look at sorry, I made some holes in this. If you look at the operational performance and the budget, if you look at on the description on income, would I say other, it's a 440%. You know, and if you mention percentage over 100% on any budget, you know, this is probably based on a traditional budget system. Zero-based budget systems will never show percentages like that. It doesn't really look good on a budget paper, even if it's in positive. ICT system stability, I think I mentioned that, on 97% achieved, which is really not good. Then on corporate education and awareness, the focus was to encourage youth to become entrepreneurs through the CIPC online registration. Actually, the youth still complain that the CIPC never comes back to them. I suppose that every case is treated on its own merit, so maybe that could be your answer to that. The capital expenditure on that's also, you know, that there was already a fear of the CIPC financial status that they pre-assess the companies and the intellectual property registration office. CIPRO received a qualified order before, so with this, but this is not huge figures on the capital operational expenditure, which is more than the total income. But with 3 million or more companies registered on your database, you know, I'm surprised that the expenditure is actually more.
Right. You've got 20 seconds left, and if you're talking to the mic, please, Honourable Yes, Jehosa.
Well, thank you.
Right. Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Acting Commissioner, for being here. It seems there's certainly areas of improvement and growth, and that's satisfying to see. But just a question to Ms. Galt, who's here from the DTI. Former Commissioner Luden resigned on the 20th of April 2016, and still the Commissioner's post has not been filled. You know, why are we sitting with an 18-month delay in the sculpt, and what is the timeline to fill the commissioner's post? Because I think, you know, without, you know, certainty, you know, sort of, I think it follow with the greatest of respect of sort of, you know, bailing the water out of, a ship with holes, and he's desperately trying to fill them. But I think at some point there needs to be finality to that decision. Advocate, then to you, what is the completed timeline for the rollout of the self-service terminals, and what is the status of being able to, you know, register your business and then, you know, do your SARS clearance or applications for tax certificates or tax clearance? I know that's something that we've been talking about since you've been in a position. And I think that would go a long way to assisting businesses, because quite frankly speaking, the easy part now is registering the business, but it's the follow-up on the tax clearance. The issue of runners has been long outstanding, certainly since I've been here. You were going to do investigations into who the access points into the CIPC were for the runners, because, hey, we're getting the job done a lot quicker. Then someone went and did it themselves. I'd just like an update on that. And then we'd also had some discussion the last time you were here about business rescue practitioners. It turned out some of them were bogus. Some of them, you know, had no idea, you know, what they were doing. Then there were also cases where it was one or two of the same people who were being used over and over. I'd just like to get an update on how that has progressed. And the big issue is the labor issue. I mean, I know that is something that predates your acting appointments. I would like to think that, you know, as you said, you know, things have got better, but, you know, they only get better until the next problem arises. So just sort of your honest, frank assessment of where you are with the unions there. And then I was concerned with your slide on business rescue that there had only been one proceeding that had started for the current financial year. Is that correct, or am I missing something there? Because it's been quite a big uptick from 2014 to 2015, and I don't know if that's correct. Thank you.
Honourable MacPherson. Honourable William.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, I just want to welcome the presentation. I have just a quick comment to make about the presentation. In the slides, the first slides that we received, these ones here, they're far too small. Nobody can read them. I think you should make the full page next time, because you can't read this. Can't read it. Okay. Thank you. Then I'd like to move on to what the Auditor General told us yesterday, raising concern about the following points, and I'd like to know what you're doing about them. Under the title of leadership, the Auditor General was concerned about the oversight responsibility, the HR management, and ITC governance, and also under financial performance and management, the Auditor General was raised concern about accurate and complete records, IP design, and finance review and monitoring. And I'd like to know, what are you going to do about those? This is what the Auditor General reported to us yesterday, and they were part of your findings. So we'd like to know what you're going to do about those. I also want to, I'm a little bit concerned that for the previous financial year, the one that we're looking at, there was a 14% underspend. And I just want to know, you know, you're not really here to make profit. You're here to deliver the service. So I just want to know, in light of the Auditor General's concerns, why was there this 14% underspend? And also, just to also agree with Honourable MacPherson on his question, I want to know, when will the self-service rollout be completed, in particular in Mpumalanga? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Yes. How many of you from Mpumalanga? Honourable Mkongi?
No, thank you very much, President. No, I just want, firstly, to welcome the presentation from this. I think we know what's our agenda. Our agenda as the current fifth parliament is to accelerate the radical transformation, both socially and economically. And part of our duties as departments and entities is to make sure that we plan in line with the national goals, based on the strategic medium-term strategic framework and the money that we use in the medium-term financial framework. Jefferson, we are reported here on company registration. I've asked this question several times. It does not come up clearly. The relationship between company registration and the transformation in practice of the Republic of South Africa. I'm asking this question to relate to matters of funding. The companies that register, and then you agree that they are right, they must register. They have found that they are fronting after registration. So what is the relationship between company registration and the transformation imperatives of the Republic of South Africa? That's the first question. The second question is around the principles of business rescue. How do you relate your principles of business rescue in relation to the transformation imperatives also? which relate to broad-based black economic empowerment. Quote, which are these companies that were rescued? Are they complying with our laws? And then if they are not complying, why are we still rescuing them? Are these companies complying with the laws of Labor Relations Act, Conditions of Employment Act, and other related questions? Jefferson, I the one who's raised this matter, but I don't know the meeting. I was trying to get interest now to go and check the meeting that I raised this matter. I'm going to raise it again. CFC is saying that it's going to go investigate or research about the decline in the registration of the cooperatives. I proposed that thing months ago, that because you indicated that there is a threat in terms of the decline in the registration or deregistration of cooperatives, I said you either do the best step or research or investigate what could be the reason for such a decline. Because the reason might not be the issue of incentives only. There might be other related issues that make this particular decline, you know, of this. There are many questions. You're talking about copyright. And in your report, you take this copyright freedom issue as one of the other issues. There's a serious threat here. One man in the SABC have taken a decision and announced that decision about 90% local content. What are your plans to mitigate such increase, if there's going to be any, in filmmaking in South Africa? Because if there's going to be 90% local content, then that means our people on the ground must write their stories, and those stories must go to the television. So to have a plan, if there could be, you know, a drastic increase in terms of the registration of the copyright in films. I'm not going to go further because in terms of the Auditor General issues, I think I'm represented very well here. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mkhombi. Yes, and there you have it, Advocate Father, to you and your team, if you would pick up on those responses. I think one question was directed to yourself, was it, Ms. Saltz? Right.
Thank you very much, honorable members, for those questions. I'll answer some of them, and my team will answer some of them. Regarding the first question from Honorable Essayism, regarding the issue of the impact on the acting positions and the suspension of the CFO, I think somewhat Honorable McPherson also directed at that. The ECI, I think, is very similar in terms of that. But regarding the functioning of the organization during this time, it's been 17 going on 18 months. The organization continued to function. It still continued to carry out its mandate fully. It continued to deal with the issue of improving on its mandate and improving on its functionality and its customer service, and therefore the impact has not been severe. I think maybe the impact as far as the load on myself has been quite heavy because I'm taking on two responsibilities. But we try to manage that, to deal with it as best as we can in order for us to continue with our service delivery. Regarding the issue of the CFO, who has been on suspension now for a while, the matter has been ongoing for many, many months. I think it's actually ongoing during the course of this week, or if not next week. It has set for many, many, many various things. There have been lots of applications that have been made. It's been chaired by a senior counsel in Johannesburg Bar, and it continues to take a normal course. Regarding the issue of the turnaround times, if you see the audit report, Honorable Member, you will see that when it comes to how we deal with our service delivery standard, which is audited, we have consistently met our service delivery standard. So much so that company registrations have been done fairly, fairly quickly. What we need to do is that we need to have more consistency in it. That's something I can definitely state. We can do 95% of them within a service delivery standard and very, very quickly. We have 5% that have fallen out of it and take very, very long, and we therefore have lots of issues regarding that. So I have been encouraging staff and encouraging the management to say that we must consistently do the same thing all the time. If our turnaround time is 2 days, it must be 100% 2 days, or as close to that as possible. We can't seem to be doing it for part of the time. So consistency is certainly something that we're going to be working on in the coming year. not only in terms of the way that we automate, not only in terms of how we train our staff and to deal with that, but also on how we interact with our clients. Making sure we have proper feedback mechanisms, making that our credit resolution system, when there are issues regarding registrations, are dealt with swiftly, because that is certainly a complaint, and I can take it on, is that I think we as an organization are not consistent in the way that we resolve queries. I think that's where the problem lies. Our stable IT platform is going to certainly is something that's also a large focus. You can see from our expenditure, it's something that we place a lot of emphasis on. We will be dealing with something called a future view. And a lot of that will encompass a lot of hardware changes in this coming year to provide additional stability to our IT platform. If you would see, and I mentioned it, and I'm not shy away from it, we have, for example, an outage in our first quarter, which lasted longer than I would like it to have lasted. It reduced time for our turnaround times and obviously caused a lot of queries to enter the system. If we need to be more stable, we need to understand that we need to enhance more, and we need to understand that we need to spend the money to enhance more. But, as my CFO said, we work in government, we have to be very, very cautious when it comes to how we procure, especially in the environment, and take into account the legislation that governs us, and therefore we take this approach. But we need to understand that as a customer service delivery agency, we need to deliver it in a more stable fashion. And IT is certainly a driver for our stability regarding that. Regarding allocation of funds, we started a process and a project which is going to be a new billing system. Out of the queries that we get, I think 50% of them is around allocations and 100% under the space. The allocation of funds is certainly an issue because it's the reference number that sometimes gets mixed up. If one digit goes out or if there is something that's added to it, which many clients do, because many of our clients are once-off. We have large intermediaries that we deal with, but we also deal with once-off clients go to a bank and deposit money into the CIPC account. And that is where the problem lies a lot of time. We need to change that billing system. To make it understand that we need to be more online, I think we need to accept credit cards, for example, and lots of new things need to be done and innovative needs to be done as far as the billing and the allocation of funds is concerned. It's still a concern. We still receive a lot of queries around it. We've educated. We've contacted the banks. We've put up stuff on our website. Part of our campaign that we're rolling out, our media campaign, is around educating people about the allocation of funds, but we still see it as a problem going forward in the organization. Honourable, we have not had any strike or labour instability in the last 18 months. There has never been a strike, there has never been issues around the performance of staff, as far as that is concerned. The last time we had such industrial action was the beginning of last year. And therefore, in the period from April, May, up until now, there has not been any significant industrial action by staff. There have not even been applications to the CCMA. The completion of the timeline for the rollout of SSTs in the various provinces, I must admit, is a bit of a tricky one. The reason why it's a tricky one is because a lot of the time we are reliant on the partners we use. Let me just go back to one of the slides. What we do is we send notice of intention to roll out a province to various stakeholders in the provinces. Economic development houses, chambers of commerce, municipalities, various partners. But we need them to respond to us. Many provinces take very, 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 very long. And Honourable Willis, maybe I should ask for your assistance in Mpumalanga, because we're trying to negotiate currently with Economic Development Department in that province, who do not seem to be getting back to us. So, as I said, it's a passion of mine to have this. Our self-service technology and our self-service terminals in every province, because service is our people on the ground. And therefore, if any assistance can be given in your area, I certainly will appreciate it. But as I said, some provinces jump at it. They basically want to collaborate, sign our MOUs very, very quickly, and we basically deploy very, very quickly. As I said, we're going to be dealing with the Free State very, very soon. We certainly enhancing our relationship in Northern Cape. Limpopo is taking extremely, extremely long. North Grace and Mpumalanga are two provinces that are taking, and the response has not been very, very good. So, a timeline is very difficult for me to say because we want the partners to respond in order for us to deal with that particular service. Honourable McPherson, regarding the issue of the tax clearance certificates, is a very, very good question. We had, as CIPC, a very, very good relationship with the staff. We met every second week, every Friday afternoon was a standing meeting between commissioners and teams, IT teams and strategy teams, and we did a lot of things. Basically, if you register for a company now, the information flows straight to and you get it at your tech number. But as far as additional service regarding a tech status certificate, it hasn't gone that route as yet. We are trying to rebuild the relationship with SAS. It's somewhat more difficult because the team at SAS that we come with are not there anymore. If I can say it like that. But we are trying to rebuild the relationship with SAS because we firmly believe in the whole issue of our information moving between to SAS and SAS information moving to us, which we currently have the gateway. But as for the rollout of additional services like tax clearing certificates or even the information being used for VAT registration, we do not have it as yet. At all. Regarding the issue of the runners, if anybody who comes to the CIPC and the PCI campus these days, you would not see tons and tons of people standing outside as it used to be before. We've done two things. One is we moved our service center, Victoria Service Center, out of the campus and we put it in the Sunny Park, where the Sunny Park management does not allow it because we've had meetings with them. It's not allowed people to stand around and tout. And the second thing that we've done, in order to deal with the issue of the access to the system, is that where previously an application could be brought directly to a staff member's access, that is not allowed because the system now allocates it on a random basis. So if 10 of us apply on the online portal, because as I said, we're more online than paper, nobody will know who gets it. So staff member A will not know that he's getting an application from this particular customer because the system randomly gives it to anybody in that particular area. So it's very, very difficult for a client or a customer to want to fast track an application through some sort of relationship that somebody has with somebody in the office. The second thing is we don't allow people in the building. We don't allow people to walk on the floors. You have to have a meeting to set up. We basically send staff down. And if you come to the CIPC, you will not see lots of people standing outside or lots of people in the building accordingly. Because we curb that by using online security measures in order for us to allocate the applications. Regarding the issue of business rescue the regulation and compliance around business rescue, we were pleased to know that we have actually struck off some business rescue practitioners, and I use the word quite strongly. When it comes to the functioning of a business rescue practitioner, we have enhanced our licensing regime to include aspects of non-compliance with legislation. Where previously we never had that. All we used to do was deal with the issue of have you been involved in business rescue, what qualifications do you have, are you in good standing with your professional body, and therefore we will accept you. What we've done now is that when you apply to become a business rescue practitioner, we give you a whole set of compliance rules that you need to comply with in order to remain licensed. You need to submit on time, you need to call meetings on time, you need to have your reporting on time. If you want an extension, this is what the law says about an extension, and basically we hold you to those. In the last 6 months, we've received complaints about business rescue practitioners who are not compliant. We've written to them and asked them for the report. Some of them have responded, some of them have not responded. We wrote to them again, threatening them with action to say that we are to use the word loosely, strike you off or suspend your license. Those that have not come back to us, we certainly have gone that route. We suspended the license. Because it's something that we're also passionate about, that we want to have a tailor of those who are compliant and those who stick to the rules, otherwise they'll just fall apart. I always use the example of the liquidation. I would not like business rescue practitioners to go down the same route as the liquidation industry has gone down. It needs strict compliance and it needs strict rules. And it's something that we deal with. I also mentioned earlier that I've now started this forum whereby we get professional bodies, bankers and the law society and the various banks and academics from various universities. The last meeting, we probably had 50 people in the room. And basically, we laid down the law. We said that if your members do not comply with what the intent and the spirit of the legislation is and the compliance aspects of the legislation, this is the route that we're going to take. And we work very, very closely with bodies and the chairmen of the various bodies in order for them to understand that they need to keep their members checked. And as I said, as the member slips up, at least we can go also to the body as well as the petitioner, so we have a two-pronged approach when it comes to the compliance aspects and dealing with them. Regarding the issue of legal stability, you mentioned that legal stability is quite a volatile thing. It can be stable, but it can be unstable. We try to put processes in place, and the one thing that I encourage, and this is yesterday I had a meeting with one of the unions, the Public Service Association, is that there must be continuous engagement. And when you have continuous engagement, you can try and deal with the issue before they fester. Otherwise, you're not in touch with your staff, you're not in touch with the issues. We've also put in place, but I must admit, we haven't implemented fully, but over the last probably about 8-9 months, we signed off on our bargaining forum constitution to have a CIPC bargaining forum. I have to admit, I haven't had one meeting yet, because we are still dealing with issues regarding the transformation and the matching and placing exercises, which some of the issues have not been fully dealt with. And still involved in that and wrapping up some of those, which is a long history and a long-standing grievance that many ministers have had. But as I said, the two major unions in the organization, I meet with them regularly. I get called into their meetings to give feedback at their meetings. As I said, I met with the head office of the PSA yesterday. I meet regularly with the leadership of NAHU, and I try and understand what is the mood, what is the environment, and try to tackle that as best as I can. But as rightly said, which I totally agree with, legal stability is something you continuously have to work with, because it's really up at any moment. That's why we continuously engage. Regarding the last question you had, I think I have to get back to you. I think this might have been an error regarding the one of the study more. I think what happened is, because it's part of the annual report, I think there was just a column that they put forth in. But let me get back to that. I can tell you exactly what the numbers is in the 16-17 year.
What page is that?
This is a few slides, Madam Chair. Unfortunately, I don't think our presentation is
numbered. I think what I'm going to ask you...
But it's a slide on business rescue. There's a column saying 16-17, it's only one application that has started, that is certainly to be error.
Hold on.
Business rescue. The slide heading is business rescue.
No, I know we all have colleagues and staff, but if we can persuade our staff to number the slides,
I certainly must apologize.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. And I must apologize to Honourable Williams as well. Next presentation that we come, I'll certainly be sure that it's much better.
So I thought that was like what issue you raised was your last response.
No, I have some more responses. Regarding the issue of the AGN oversight, I don't think that flowed through in the report. It's part of what we would call the dashboard and the summary of the dashboard, whereby any of emphasis that we need to tackle. And the way that we tackle it, Honourable Williams, is that firstly, what we do is we dashboard them and report to them in terms of our internal audit function, so they keep a register of all of these. Also, we have something called an internal risk and fraud committee in the organization, whereby all these issues regarding what has been raised by the auditors general is being reported on by the responsible managers to see the movement month on month regarding whether they have been tackled, if they stay the same, or if they are regressing as far as that is concerned. So this is certainly a watch on it. We register it. It becomes part of our expo meeting in terms of feedback from our fraud and risk chairperson, and therefore we take it as part of our executive responsibility to watch it and make sure that there's movement on it. Okay, it's part of our dashboard. I think the last points by Honorable Nkonki. We certainly work very closely with the BEE Commission regarding fronting. Right? Remember, many of the fronting allegations, the BEE Commission has a fronting investigation unit, but many of the allegations of fronting end up our door because we've got an investigation wing, an enforcement unit at the CIP. So what we do is we then engage with them, because many times fronting is but one, there are many other allegations contained, the allegations of fraud, fronting, non-compliance to legislation, so we work as teams regarding that. Also, many of the aspects of fronting and non-compliance also end up at a body called the Company Tribunal. So we have a three-way relationship between all these parties in order for us to deal with it in a consistent and a collaborative manner. But the relationship between ourselves and the BEE Commission is certainly strong. I know the BEE Commissioner very, very well, Zodwa and Bully, and we try and coordinate our efforts regarding those matters. The next part that you mentioned regarding what what we're doing as far as the transformation imperatives and business registry is concerned. Let me say the one thing that disturbs me somewhat, and also it goes back to what we're doing in the forum and the committee that I've set up, is this issue about the same practitioners getting the work all the time. We've got about 230 business registry practitioners or thereabouts, but we've got 2,000 business registries. We see the same names cropping up all the time. So in the particular committee, we've done a terms of reference. And one of the terms of reference, this is applicable to professional bodies who have members in the business registry space, is for them to undertake a transformation program. The one thing that we're going to deal with is something called supervision of new practitioners. When I say new practitioners, I mean practitioners in the previously disadvantaged space, black practitioners who must come through in the space, who must learn about the aspects of business rescue. It is now included as part of their charters, and we watch it very, very closely. We deal with supervision, we deal with mentorship, and we deal with training programs to make sure that these new practitioners coming through that deal with the transformation of this new industry, because I firmly believe it's a new industry, it's a new profession that's coming in. We also work closely with the Black Lawyers Association. We go out and we train the members, we speak to them, we have relationships with them, they come and visit us, and we basically try to deal with this aspect of empowering new black practitioners in the space of business. Something that's very, very important to us, and something that we stress all the time when we deal with the issue of how do we engage and how do we bring about a transformation imperative and a transformation agenda to the professional bodies whose members are responsible for business. You're right. I specifically remember you mentioned this issue about co-ops and the reduction in the co-op numbers. As I said, a few months back, I met with the DG of the Small Business Ministry, and I mentioned this aspect to her, because that particular function, when the Small Business Ministry came about, that function was taken out of the DTA and moved to Small Business, the co-op unit. They're responsible for the co-op legislation, as well as the co-op schemes and processes. And I mentioned it specifically to her, and she was quite surprised and a bit shocked about it. So we agreed at a particular meeting that there must be a study must be undertaken regarding this, especially in the provinces, because the provinces is where co-ops see their lives, where co-ops seem to take on community and community aspects. So she agreed at a particular meeting, she had a whole team with her. We will work closely as CIPs with them, because we have the data. Because they register with us. So we have the data, we know who they're functioning, we know who's being registered in the co-operative space, we can see the numbers, as you said, on the decline, and therefore we can understand it. They have agreed to it, I need to get back to them, I have to admit, but they need to do a research on co-ops and declining numbers. That's it for me.
Thank you, Acting Commissioner. I'd just like to address the questions that you raised pertaining to the finance. Right. I think the first question was the 147 performance or overperformance on the other income when you look at our March 2016 figures. And Chair, what is to point out there is that what we do as the CIPC, what goes into the other income, so I can get it. What tends to go into the other income revenue is basically the prescription of unidentified funds at year end. So what we do generally in business is that we don't put that in our budget. So if you were to compare that against our budget, that's why you find that there's quite a huge variance. The reason that we don't do that is because it's not really operationally driven. During the planning process, it's not really our focus point. We cannot really estimate in terms of how much of our clients that have funds with us will be able to successfully pay the refunds of their funds as well as utilize the balances that they have with us within any particular financial year. So estimating that and bringing it on our budget is not really operationally driven, but it's really based on the prescription of such. And I must also point out that as well, if clients can successfully claim or prove that such funds which have been prescribed belong to them, our policy is that we do refund such clients. So yes, I do agree that the percentage looks quite strange, but it's purely because we do not put it in our budgeting process because it's not operationally driven. It's purely based on the extent that clients do utilize those funds within a particular financial year. The second question that was raised is in terms of the 14% It's still on the same slide, 14% if you compare the expenditure, which was the 411 million budget, vis-a-vis the 351 actual expenditure, which then resulted in the 14% underspending. I think the question was that what was the impact of that in terms of service delivery and operations. Just a point of note, there are detailed explanations that I will go into high level at this, in this presentation on page 97 of the annual report. But one of the key things that one has pointed out is that it was previously raised by this house in when we were presenting annual report for the previous financial year, was a point that was raised by the Auditor General then to say that the AG was concerned about the extent of reliance that CIPP has on ICT consultants. We have as management really taken extra measures to ensure that we have significant savings in terms of digitalization as well as reliance of business on ICT consultants or external consultants. Therefore, we have employed, obviously with the support of both organized labor and the action and the ICT commissioner, be able to convert some of those consultancy positions or tasks into more permanent roles. So all in all, in terms of savings and the ICT consultancy expenditure, it's about 18 million versus what was actually budgeted for. The other area that had an impact as well was with regards to the establishment of our self-service terminals. Initially, when we were budgeting at the beginning of the financial year for 2016, what we had in our minds as the Commission was that we were going to establish fiscal offices throughout the provinces where we were targeting to establish these centers. But as we went around, it became much more practical and much more quicker and much more business efficient for us to actually collaborate with some of the government institutions that were already in those provinces. I think in KZN we're dealing with yes, Durban Chamber of Commerce. I think in Limpopo they said it's a leader, Limpopo Economic Development. So what you tend to see happening in terms of the impact on the actual spending is that service delivery not affected, but we then were able to establish SSPs quicker. But you save on your rental costs, you save on your security costs, you save on your maintenance costs and all the related costs in terms of establishing physical offices in those provinces. The one last significant factor as well that had impact in terms of the 14% saving is when we had our media campaign. I think that was budgeted at about 10 million in the previous financial year. We had a couple of delays in terms of starting off with that. It only commenced in the last quarter and the last month of the financial year, which was February 2015. So you see the expenditure for that going through into the 2017 financial year. So all in all, in summary, the impact on service delivery was quite minimal, if one can put it that way. And the most impact to the 14% was really the implementation of cost containment of cost saving measures. The second question, the third question rather, was with regards to, there was a question on the allocation of funds, which I think my commissioner has touched on, but I think what I'd also like to highlight is that yes, I do agree that it has been a long-standing matter, but to also remind the House that at CIPC we did try, I think about 5 years ago, to go out on a drive to provide a new billing system or revenue management system. And I think the supply chain challenges and that matter is still under litigation. I think it's been 5 or 6 years now with Vela IT. So we have started recently, as the Acting Commissioner has pointed out, to try and carefully and cautiously start a new procurement process and resuscitate, you know, the procurement of a revenue management system that will ensure the ease allocation of our time funds. The last question had to do with capital expenditure. Yes. Can't remember if it was in the first quarter or if it was in the annual report, but I think nevertheless our spending patterns are still the same in terms of we generally tend to struggle in terms of our spending for capital expenditure. If you look at our budget for capital expenditure, it's mainly driven by ICT. So you look at your computer and then you look at your software. The reason for that minimal spending that area, yes, is because of the previous challenges that we've had in past years and where some matters are still under litigation happening. But the most important factor is well that what we need to consider is that CIPC, in terms of CapEx development, which is related to the technology, is that we need to build some of our systems and customize some of our systems in-house. So what then generally happens is that the development of such systems, because they are customized, will normally happen over a longer period of time. For example, the new technology platform that Acting Commissioner was referring to, as much as the spending for that is significant, the plan for it, I think, it has taken about almost two to three years now, and it's unfolding in various stages. So that does have an impact in terms of to what extent to utilize our CAPEX pilot. I think that was all. Chair, I hope I'm not missing any other questions on financial performance.
If you have, you will come back in writing.
Thank you, Chair. Just in response to Honourable McPherson's question, the approach taken by the DTI had been that we needed to make sure that it was adherence to the strategy, that the organisation was stable and we worked with the leadership following the labour instability. And I think the report from the Acting Commissioner has borne fruit to that approach, but we need to stabilise. Interviews were conducted for the Commissioner on the 6th of June. We've had competency assessments done as well as property checks. The process is in the final stages of approval, so it's not yet finalised. We are hoping that we get an announcement shortly. And then, Honourable Chair, if I could just also respond to Honourable Williams' question about the AGM or the AG's day. The Minister has asked all the public entities who have had issues on the audit report for clean audit plan. That is then monitored by all of the audit committees. They report into our audit committee. I think there's a meeting later this month that's been convened. And we've also recently established a chief audit executive fora with which all of the internal audit teams of all of the public entities look at issues around internal control environments and to see how we can manage them. But that process is quite tightly managed, and we also ask public entities to report on that on a quarterly basis. And I think we are getting those reports, and we're looking to assist where we can as the DGI. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you very much. I'm mindful of our time, and there were a couple of questions that I would have liked the SLAPEC to respond to briefly. One was regarding the call centre management and the low target level set. Now, you may have missed this while I was out, but it does appear, just look at the face of it, as if that, you know, the low target remains low and there are challenges in the call centre. I heard your response to one of the other questions, which seemed to indicate otherwise, but perhaps you would just re-emphasise. The other thing is there was a recommendation of the Portfolio Committee. Has the CIPC implemented this to include the work attending calls of the call centre into job descriptions? Has that been done as a performance indicator? The other one is, you know, I've heard this in some of the responses, that you you didn't refer to it as rationalisation, but some of the challenges you were facing and how you were dealing with them. But have you, you know, you have undergone this rationalisation. There has been, if you like, an element of restructuring there. You yourself have indicated the, you know, that staff posts are not all full. You have an acting CFO, for example. You yourself are acting. So when can we expect this to be rationalised? Because I thought it was implicit in what you said earlier that you were going to identify critical areas and ensure that those posts were filled. Can you just get a response from you on that particular one? I will send this along to you for a full response, but if you could give us just a quick response back on this particular one. Thank you very much, Advocate Fowler. Honourable Williams, I want short questions now. Honourable Mkongi.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just have one question. It's about the irregular expenditure to the amount of 6 million rand to the overpaying of employees, and I just want to know what steps have been taken to reverse these payments. Thank you.
Well, in
Kongi, followed by Honourable Yesterhazer.
No, it's a few proposals, Mr. President, that I want to advance.
Honourable Yesterhazer.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to comment on something that Acting Commissioner said. I know I read it last night, and I've just heard that the CIPC changed his planning article that says that when the minister and his officials visited the CIPC in July, they were met by angry and rowdy group members of staff that asked for Luden's dismissal for one thing, recognized the union to be recognized, etc. July next year, so it's not 18 months, it's about 13.
No, thank you. Is this, well, Honourable MacPherson?
Just a follow-up for you, Chair. I think it's concerning what the acting commissioner has told us with the relation between TARS and themselves. And I think that there needs to be an engagement, maybe facilitated by us, with TARS or Treasury. Because, you know, it's one thing to get a registration of business, but one of the things that really holds up and sort of burdens new businesses is VAT and tax appearances. So I'd really like to put that to you, that you facilitate that engagement.
Right. So basically you're asking the committee, because at one stage I thought you were requesting that they have an engagement themselves. I mean, that certainly there's no reason why they should not pursue that at the earliest opportunity, but that does not, of course, obviate your second point. Do you have a third point?
It's a point of clarity. Maybe you weren't, I'm very busy with Mr. Beema, but what the acting commissioner had said. So, well then,
for the committee to facilitate such an engagement.
Because
and
I'm it's saying broken down between them and staff, so that's why we need to
In the first instance, I'm asking the acting commissioner to do that himself, in the first instance, and then for the committee to take it up. That's what I'm saying. Right. Honourable Mkongi is now going to come with some proposals once the CIPC have responded shortly to the questions, and then we'll close off with your proposals.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Regarding the call center, look, I don't think it's the level we want it to be at, but we've certainly made a lot of strides. In the last few months, we've employed 12 to 13 more call center agents. We've also employed 3 more managers in the call center, and basically we've seen a bit of an increase in the calls being answered. So much so that I get a report from the call center manager, and I see one last week, to say that we consistently, over the period of last week and the week before, answering calls between 70% and 75%. It's still not good enough. To me, it's not good enough. But there has certainly been an increase, because we previously used to answer between 40% and 50% of our calls. So the increased number of call center agents is certainly making a difference. The issue of new management and getting new leaders involved in the process is certainly making a difference. There's some technology that we need to also introduce in terms of the call center, and we need to get back what we would call a traditional call center model. The job descriptions for the call center agents are there. As I said, we've employed new people based on new job descriptions for them. We've done away with what we would call the Swedish model that was previously attempted. It does not work in the organization, and we got back to the where you call a number and we answer the call. As I said, I am still not happy with the call answer rates. I think we need to have more bums on seats, as it were, in terms of more call center agents. We're trying to restructure that around to find them in the organization and basically to get more recruitment in that area. It flows into the next question that you asked, Chair. The next question you spoke about, the rationalization of the post. I'd like to answer this in a different way. And you consistently hear me speak about how we as an organization use technology to service our clients. It's something that the minister is very, very strong on. It is something that we as an organization see it as part of our strategy. So as we get better at technology, as we get better at access and better at processing,
We then free up other staff members. And that's exactly what we're seeing in the organization currently. I did mention earlier that we need to have a very strict change management process and the process of redeploying staff in areas that technology has taken over. That is the reason why I firmly believe that we will never get to a point where we fill our 634 posts. There is no way. I recall at one stage Honorable Williams mentioning this point at the last time I was here. He said, don't fill your posts willy-nilly. I think that's exactly what he said. He said, look at what gains you can get out of your strategy and basically see how you can deal with that. And that's exactly what we've done. I know that we are having an expo meeting that has been set up also to deal with the issue of how we are going to look at our structure and what posts we feel that we do not need anymore in the organization, going back to the point about the rationalization and engagement with the unions as far as that is concerned. I firmly believe that our numbers will probably peak at about maybe 550 because we need patient examiners in new areas, but in areas that we're getting sufficiency and gains in technology, we certainly need redeployment and repositioning of those particular posts. We've got an issue, Honorable Williams, on the irregular expenditure. We had a very big fight with the Auditor General regarding this area. And let me tell you where it came about from. And my ex-CFO did allude to it. She said that we were at the final stages of our restructuring process and our changing over from Cipro to CIPC. And that is part of that process. So basically what happened was, when the organization was dealing with the remuneration framework all the way back in 2012 and 2013, there was a movement of staff who are on basic salary and benefit structure to a two-company structure across the board for every single staff member, which is a radical change for staff. It was negotiated at that point with organized labor that the areas that there were benefits, which is housing allowance and medical aid and pension and all of that, would already be maintained at a level in the public service because staff can never be worse off. Right? We can't prejudice staff from moving from Cipro, which is a public service entity, to the CIPC, which is a commission out of the public service, and prejudice them. So we implemented a remuneration framework. It was a framework, it wasn't a policy, and I'll come back to the aspect of what we do in the policy hearing. So we implemented it in 2013. In 2014, we continued to implement it. In 2015, there was a change in public service. The public service increased the housing allowance and they increased the medical allowance for public servants. So our staff came to us and they said, we can't be worse off. You know, you need to do an adjustment of these things. So we went through a negotiation consultation with organized labor. We signed up an agreement to say we will adjust it accordingly and then basically staff can see the benefit as if they were public servants. However, the problem that we had is that because we are on a cost to company structure, we then applied a cost of living adjustment which was basically, well, the housing allowance in the middle, it was more than what that had been. It therefore meant there was an overpayment of staff. The AG never picked it up. There's management picked it up. We went to them and said, we think that we there's an error of interpretation. Because interpretation for the remuneration framework documents, because we only had the documents that we could work with. We never had the previous commissioner who negotiated because she was gone, and we never had the previous acting CFO because he wasn't there. So we only could work with the documents that were before us, and we interpreted as that. We interpreted incorrectly. The AG in his report, and if you see the paragraph on this, Honorable Williams, the AG specifically says this was a problem of interpretation. It wasn't an oversight. It wasn't negligence. It wasn't willful neglect. It was something that we interpreted incorrectly. Then what happened? We then approached our audit committee to raise this, to say, okay, we coming with this issue. The audit committee firmly believes, and that's the reason why it finds itself into the audit report, they firmly believe that we received value. Because we were short-staffed, there was this moratorium, there was these grievances that were doing, staff were doing more than they're supposed to have done. So, and as CFO ever said, when it comes to the issue of the reduction in the use of consultants, we had in-house developers working on the CIP's permanent structure, we had all of these things that we gained value for. So they firmly believe, and they firmly state, that they do not believe that there should be a recovery. They should raise it as an irregular expenditure, and we should look for some sort of condemnation from the minister. We prepared this documentation as far as this is concerned, and we prepared an explanation as far as this is concerned, because we believe we receive value for this. It was just an interpretation error that was caused. On the last aspect, Honorable Esther, I think that's 2014. as June, because the commissioner was not there. I've been acting in this particular post since May, and there has not been any form of labor unrest. It's June 2014. I think that's when the article is. Okay, I'm 100% sure of that. That was from us. I think Honorable Nkongi will have.
Thank you very much. I will forward these questions on to you and so on. Just before we get the proposal, I really indicated Honorable McPherson that in the first instance should try and see whether they can engage with SARS. Now I want the second part of your proposal formally. You're proposing that the committee...
Thank you, Chair. I'm proposing that the committee holds a joint meeting with Treasury or SARS, whoever they may fall under, so we can look to align and streamline the passing of information between Subsea and SARS so that businesses can establish themselves in a quicker period.
Proposal. Do we have any objections to that at all? Theoretically, of course, and in line, because we are legal personnel here from Parliament. Is there any seconder for that proposal? Right, Honourable Williams. So I can go forward, and I'm going to be engaging with the staff, because that will look like Friday the 16th of September. Now, that's one issue at a time. Now, proposal from yourself, a set of three, Honourable Nkongi.
Thank you. Now, the first question is the question of the slippages. I'm worried about the slippages in the registration process. It is important that the committee receive a plan or a list of all those companies that have registered already or those that are also applying for registration in order to be able to monitor them. Because if they've gone through pre and post, they go through and then 3 months down the line, they are found wanting on legislation, infringing and all those. There is a serious problem. So I think that is the one. Maybe it's a template that you can just punch and then that particular company will come up and say this. That is the first one. The second one, Chairperson, I want the acting commissioner to commit to this thing. That we are going to rigorously and purposefully go and recruit this black business rescue practitioners and train them and teach them for purposes of transformation and asking us. Now this is going to help us with what is the problem about the whole transformation agenda that is blocking. Chairperson, I propose that we call a joint portfolio committee meeting with a small business development portfolio committee to discuss the issue of cooperatives. The deadline, the research, the timeline in terms of when and the intervention, because this thing is very important. Lastly, it's an impact study. This thing of SAPC, if we're not careful about it, it's going to block, it'll be in your door. SAPC is 90% localization of content. Now, I'm talking about the drama and movies that are going to come up from SAPC, from South Africans. Do we have a plan? In terms of floodgate, if that is going to take place in the future, because we cannot just operate without a plan, if this happens, what? Maybe we have a meeting with SAPC and check how many people are applying to them, and how is it going to impact on you, in terms of the copyright on films. Thank you.
We've all heard those proposals. Do we have any objection? I'm looking at the members of the committee. No real. Because that really sounds in line with what we have been asking during other meetings. I'd like to look at it fully. The proposal by Honourable McPherson was very simple, as it were, clear-cut. Yours are not that clear-cut. I didn't have a chance to write them down. So if you would ensure, Honourable Nkongi, that you do send this to me by email, and then it may, you know, we may be able to do that as well on Friday the 16th, but let us see what it involves. All right. I'm also now looking at the Acting Commissioner Advocate Fowler. Would you be available on that day? Do you want to check and email us back? So that, you know, it's quite clear. We, in the meantime, we'll make sure outstanding questions are emailed to yourself by and through our committee secretary. I'd like to thank the CRPC, okay, for being here with us this morning and giving us this, I think, explanatory information. I certainly, although I wasn't here for the whole presentation, at least I was there for the questions. So thank you to the companies and Intellectual Property Commission. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. It's been a pleasure.
Members, just so that we, I did indicate that we would have the sort of, not discussion, but that the legal, what are they calling themselves now, the Parliamentary Legal Advisor, Ms. Isaac, will take us through what has been distributed to you. So I'm going to call on Ms. Isaac to come up here, please. Now, we don't need a blow-by-blow lecture, as it were, but the key points. Thank you. Has everyone got a copy? Don't worry, I'm just thinking of your time. Thank you. You like a little comfort break, right? everyone is back. Comfort visits are over, and we return. Ms. Isaac, I think thank you for waiting there for us to get back to you. And although I'm sure you found it quite informative as well, didn't you? Right. Now, what we're looking at here is a matter that arose the other day, last week I think it was, and we just wanted to ensure that we were on track. At this age, I'm certainly not an authority on the rules, and that we will remain within the rules on this matter. The request was for the performance contract of the CEO of the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications. And as I said, just take us through the key points and then the crunch line, as it were. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to the members of the committee and the Chairperson. As the Chairperson indicated, I was asked to write a legal opinion as to whether the portfolio committee is legally entitled to the performance contract of a chief executive officer of a public entity. And as a way of background, we know that the ARCS is a public entity in terms of legislation. It is accountable to the Department of Trade and Industry, and the Portfolio Committee oversees the department, all entities that report to it. So by way of just discussing what law is applicable, if we start with the Constitution, we know that the role of the National Assembly and its committee is to scrutinize and oversee executive action. And the Constitution directs that the National Assembly must provide mechanisms of accountability and oversight over executive action. So to give effect to this power, the Constitution specifically empowers the Assembly to compel evidence and information. And in Section 56A, which is relevant to this issue, it says the National Assembly or any of its committees may summon any person to appear before it to give evidence or oath or affirmation or to produce documents. And the rules of the National Assembly, the 9th edition in Rule 1678, similarly states that for the purpose of performing its function, a committee may, subject to the Constitution, legislation, and other provisions of the rules and resolutions of the Assembly, summon any person to appear before it to give evidence, oath, or affirmation, or to produce any document. So as said on above, the committee is empowered in terms of the Constitution and the rules in scrutinizing and overseeing executive action to request that a person give evidence or to produce any document. Now, this power will be used when there is a lack of cooperation from the entity. As the normal course of events, it will be expected that public entities would cooperate to assist the committee in fulfilling its function. And therefore, the Constitution does provide a mechanism, and the rules provide a mechanism, to compel this document to be brought before the committee. From information given to me, it seems that the NRCS has claimed that the performance contract of its CEO is confidential. And I do not have any information to indicate the reasons as to why it is confidential. But just as a general rule, we know that all entities are required to draft strategic plans in terms of national treasury regulations. And the performance contract of all persons part of the entity must be the strategic plan. And these are documents which must be available to the National Treasury, to the Auditor General, and also to Parliament. And further, the performance in the information in all performance contracts must be reported on by an entity in its annual report. So that information is available to Parliament generally in its annual report. So it is therefore incumbent on the NRCS to indicate what specific information in its the performance contract of the CEO is confidential. But even if there's some confidential information, it does not preclude them from submitting this document to the committee. The rules establish ways of dealing with confidential information if it is indeed confidential. So Rule 189 of the Assembly Rule says that while the default position is that all documents are available to the public and media, when it's a confidential document, it is handled differently. And in terms of Rule 18, 189(1)(c)(d). It sets out different ways in which a document can become confidential. And in the first instance is where a confidential document is placed before the committee, and the committee declares that it is confidential. And the other way is that it is submitted, or before it is submitted to members, the chairperson orders that it be dealt with as a confidential document. Or in the other option is that after it is submitted to members, the chairperson declares that it is a confidential document. So the first way is that the committee gets a confidential document and it decides that it is a confidential document. So it still remains within the committee's discretion to make that decision. It's not confidential because the entity says so. Second option, that is before it comes to the members, the chairperson orders that this document be dealt with as a confidential document. And the third option is when it is submitted, the chairperson declares that it is confidential. So what is a confidential document? And the rules describe what this document is. So in coming to the decision as to whether this document, the performance contract, must be dealt with as a confidential document, I refer to Rule 1894 of the Assembly Rules. And it says, the process outlined above, that, where documents are treated as confidential, can only happen if the document contains information of a private nature that is prejudicial to a particular person. B, it is protected under parliamentary privilege or for any other reason, other privilege in terms of law. And C, it is confidential in terms of legislation. And lastly, if there is a media embargo, it is treated as confidential until that embargo expires. And in debating this determination, regard must be had to whether treating it as a confidential document is reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society. So that is the underlying principle. Is this reasonable to treat this document, considering all these particular options mentioned above? So, as I said, the document, performance contract, the committee is within its powers to request that document, and if it does contain confidential information, the entity must indicate which specific aspects of this contract is confidential, and then it's up to the committee or with the chairperson to decide whether the document must be treated as confidential. They cannot just say they cannot produce the document because it is confidential. Thank you, Chair.
Right, so, on the one hand, yes, all the documents must be submitted on request. On the other hand, there are provisos around the confidential nature of some information in a particular document. And I see you've given us, under point 13, the different aspects in this regard. And I think then, members, that certainly clarifies it for you, does it not? So I would say to our legal advisor, it's very difficult for me to say this is confidential before I've read it. You see, so I would need to read such a document, I'm thinking, before I could decide as chair whether it was confidential. Yeah, I just want to hear you. Thank you.
Yes, Chairperson. The options provide an opportunity for before you submit to the members for you to order that it be dealt with as confidential. So you would be entitled to read it beforehand.
A further clarification is needed, Honourable McPherson, followed by Honourable Mkongi.
Thank you very much, and thank you for that very comprehensive legal term or legal opinion. It's great to see that the People's Parliament is exactly that. That the people of South Africa can be, you know, how we hold our officials accountable. I just want further clarity around the process of declaring a document confidential. I mean, I think that your opinion is quite clear that we have every right to have that document tabled before us. What I'm concerned about is the potential roads that may be embarked about in for the chairperson to see that document and then come up with a not prejudging the decision, an arbitrary reason to state that the document is confidential. You yourself has said that the NRCS was unable to provide any reason why the document is confidential, and in fact you've gone and listed what it would mean for the document to be declared confidential. What reasons would the chairperson have to give to make a recommendation, because I would believe it would only be her recommendation and not a ruling, for that document to be declared official or confidential, and where does the decision ultimately rest? Does it ultimately rest with the committee or the chairperson?
The relevant rule that we must start with is rule 1894 as to what can be determined as confidential. So it's not a discussion that rests outside anything. It must be in terms of the rules, and obviously looking at the Constitution, which demands that the Parliament be open and transparent. So in making that decision, the person who's making it has to be guided by 194. And I think what is relevant here would be, does contain any information of a private nature that is prejudicial to a particular person? Because I don't know of any law that precludes a performance contract. I'm not sure whether the other sections will be applicable unless the entity does say so. But does a contract contain that information? So there's three options as to who can declare, or three ways it can be declared confidential in terms of the rule. And that is rule 189, C and D. 189, 1, C and D. So the first option is, the document is placed or presented to the committee as a confidential document. So entity will come and say, this document is confidential, and, you know, for whatever reason. And then the committee declares, yes, okay, we understand why you have come to this decision. We agree that it's confidential. The other option is, it is submitted or to be submitted to members of the committee as a confidential document by all of the chairperson of the committee. So it's submitted to the members, and the chairperson says this must be treated as a confidential document. So that's 189.1D1. And the second option, any document after its submission to members is declared by the chairperson as a confidential document. So those are the options that the rules provide for as to how confidential documents may be declared as such.
The one point, though, that may puzzle members is C under 13, your point 13C, are confidential in terms of legislation. What kind of legislation would you be looking at here? I'm sure it wouldn't be anything that would be before the committee, but just so that we get an understanding.
I don't know the specific legislation right now, but I would think it's more with intelligence matters that would be classified and dealt with in terms of legislation, because they do specify a specific committee could only deal with intelligence issues. But as to the legislation that this committee may oversee, unless there's a specific provision in, it has a lot of...
I'm not aware of any of our legislation where that would apply, but are you quite right, intelligence, etc.? Having said that, what I will do in this regard is study it myself. Thank you very much for your work. We appreciate it. And should we have any further clarification, we will come back to you. You indicated you didn't wish to speak. Right? Honourable Mkongi?
No, everything I wanted to contribute, because for me, I think the clarification and also the document that was given is clear to me. It's instructive to us, and also is based on the rules of the National Assembly. I don't think we can alter this now, unless we could have altered it when our people were dealing with the rules. Do you still remember there were the rules that were adopted? No. We could have guided that. Here is clear, it's putting the chairperson at the center of decision making and her recommendation or his recommendation to the committee at the particular time. So I would like us to adopt this as a practice based on the rules of Parliament and not try to write new rules. Because if we're going to say that chairperson is going to recommend in the committee, it is not here. There's no recommendation here. There's instructive thing. So Honorable Chairperson, just adopt this and then say that the Chairperson will study it further and then we progress according to the rules of the National Assembly.
It is, of course, based on the rules, but also the Constitution itself, as I think you prefaced your points with. Is that right, Ms. Isaac? And I'm submitting this to you. There's no reason for us to dispute it on the basis of rules. The only thing that may arise, as we've learnt, the number of lawyers in South Africa who are fully employed, is the interpretation of the same rule. That's what it rests on. So, having said that, we have our own parliamentary interpretation. And as chair, I think we have, you know, we should accept it here. But should we have a further need for clarification, we will, of course, resort to you again. Thank you for your time. Right, and members, thank you. Thank you, Honourable Mkongi. Now, I'll close the matter. Now, I'm just reminded that we needed a process, to have undergone a process first, before putting it down. Now, I have closed. You've seen enough, Honourable MacPherson. Do you have an objection? To me personally, I would like first to adopt this. Right. So we can then carry on. A proposal has been made that we use it precisely as a legal interpretation from our parliamentary legal advisor on our rules and the Constitution and use it for operational purposes in the committee. We've got a proposer. Do we have a seconder? Honourable Mantash, do you have any objections to using it as a guide? No. Right. Now, Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Can I just get then a commitment from you when you will be dispensing with this matter or requesting for the document from the NRCS and how you intend proceeding?
I indicated at the time, after seeking legal advice, which we now have, that would guide us on whether or not we could request this. All right? And this is precisely what you're asking me. What are we now going to pursue the action we committed ourselves to, dependent upon the legal advice which we would obtain? Honourable Mkongi, is it on the same point?
Also, what legal advice, what are going to be our powers also as members of Parliament? Because before you go and request that confidential information, we must agree whether it's our position as a committee that you must go and ask that information. So I think that advice is very important because we need also to vote. We can vote on that. Whether you need to go and waste your time and request documents that are unnecessary. You know, so what is our request as members in terms of that particular request?
You're now taking us back to the point of the request that was made last week for the contract of the CEO. It was not refused. We must make that quite clear. However, it was pointed out to the committee that this was already in the strategic plan. So there was no refusal to hand it in. So that needs to be clear. But I also felt that I didn't want to create a precedent in the committee. I do not see that this creates the precedent. In the past, we have had a confidential document in a previous term. And we had to tell members this was a confidential document. It contained items of a personal nature. But we were allowed to see it, access the information we required. After that, I had the document collected after it was studied. So in that respect, I think we've got to work out an operational way. So the question before you then is, do you still, having had the strat plan of the NRCS, do you still require? And you made the proposal on law. MacPherson, can you repeat it?
Just, Chairperson, I just want to get clarity. I'm sure that we had agreed to request to obtain the the performance contract subject to clarity from this. That decision was taken by this committee. We can't now go back and say, well, now we don't want it.
You are now required in the light of this information, which is around the confidentiality in the handling, that does add something else to what you may not have known before. I did not fully appreciate that. So, in the light of that information, which to me now is clear, it doesn't say you may not proceed. That's not what it's saying. But in the light of that, I'm asking you, do you wish now to make the formal proposal that we now, on the basis of this clarity, request the document? Honourable Mayor.
So, Chair, I'll ask again. I'm quite sure that this committee took a decision that we would obtain or request the document subject to this saying that we could. This is said that we can do so. So therefore, the original decision stands.
Oh, and that's why I'm asking you to go forward with it, because it now puts in certain processes and procedures as to how it should be handled. And there may be a member who's not comfortable with that. So I'm asking you to repeat it. This is information you did not have before. You didn't. So saying that a document can be clear, confidential, and you handle it in a particular way. You process it in a particular way, all right? We don't know that it even has got private information. We don't know that because no one has seen the document. So I'm certainly almost 100% certain there's no legislative reason why, you know, this would be confidential. So I can only think of private nature that's prejudicial to a particular person. That's the only thing I can think. There's no media embargo. You follow? So look at that carefully. 13.A, that is the one I've asked you to look at. Rest would not apply. So I don't want to debate. I'm going to actually make a ruling after this. Thank you. Person?
Are we going to, can we then please access or request the performance contract of the CEO?
NRCS CEO. That's a formal proposal seconded by Honourable Esterhazen. Are there any objections? Formal request, but I want it handled and processed in the manner that we have been advised to pursue. Am I correct? I will also ask the legal advisor to be present that day, because we're walking carefully in this direction. Thank you very much. There we are. That difficult? No. Let's get back to the agenda, shall we? I'd like to thank you. You may leave now, and thank you for your time. Can we just get my... attendance here today, I'm sure this was noted by the chairperson at the time, and that was the Honourable Williams. I'm sure you acknowledged Mr. Damana, did you? No. All right. In attendance is the Department of Trade and Industry, who have been here all along. Ms. Goldie Skulls, Chief Financial Officer.
and Dr. Damana, Chief Director, Industrial Development Division. Then in attendance from SAS, the South African Bureau of Standards, we have Dr. Michelle Makulu, thank you, CEO. We have Ms. Masako, right? That is, yeah, you know, I haven't seen you that frequently, so I'm never too sure. Chief Financial Officer. We have Mr. Plaikis, yes, Corporate Services Executive. And perhaps you would like to lead the team in a presentation. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. Good day. It's always a pleasure to come to Parliament to present to the committee about the work of the SABS. I'd like to also acknowledge the colleagues that support our work from the DPI, Dr. Damana and Ms. Gott. Like the previous entity, we've also been asked to present on our 2015-2016 annual report and the first quarter results. Honourable members, to get started, within the PTI family, the SABC is one of the oldest entities established in 1945 alongside the CSR and the United Nations. We celebrate our anniversary with those two important organisations. Last year, we celebrated our 70 years of existence. I thought it was important then to take the members, the honourable members, from that time of 1945 to 2008 and try and paint the picture of the organisation that went through a change. There are new entities today that have been established out of the SABS and the CSR. SANAS is one of those entities, the NRCS out of the 2008 legislation change, the MISA was also established from taking sections of the SABS and sections of the CSR. So we have that history of institutional establishment in the country. But major changes that have affected this environment came from 1987. When the previous government adopted what we call framework autonomy. In their framework autonomy, government gave a directive, that the previous government gave a directive that these entities must generate their own revenue. And it is that directive that resulted in a number of entities, including the CSR, and other research organizations that are equivalent to the SABS, having to derive part of their revenue from contract research. In 1996, the new government came up with what we call the White Paper on Science and Technology, and that white paper raised some concerns about framework autonomy and directives that had been issued by the previous government, but did not do much to treat its unintended consequences. And the unintended consequence of that framework autonomy directive was that the policy imperatives of government became a secondary issue for these entities. The entities became focused on survival, generating their own revenue and using their capabilities to try and survive and generate revenue. So there was a disconnect between the policy directives and what the entities end up doing due to financial impact of the framework autonomy directive. So in 2008, when the legislation was changed, the entity had gone through these policy directives that came from 1987, 1996, 2008, then are joined in there. when the regulator was then moved to an NRCS outside of the SABS, the NABS has the infrastructure, was left with the directives of 1987 and 1996, and I'm going to talk to the impact of those. So the work of the SABS is divided into two, and it comes from again that 1987 directive and reconfirmed in the new democratic presentation in 1996 in the white paper. There is a government-funded mandate, and that government-funded mandate is at the moment funded at 23%. And that mandate has to do with international trade obligations that the country has, its standards development. We use the grants that we get from government to pay membership fees for the country in ISO, IEC, and various international bodies. We use part of that grant to go to Geneva to argue for issues of not only South Africa, but developing countries and the dynamics that exist in developed and developing countries when we talk about issues of standardization and trade. We also, in that 23%, have to fund industry partly to attend the international meetings. But the heavy funding part means that an SME or an NGO or a consumer will then struggle to attend the meeting on behalf of the country because it's partly funded. And you end up finding a situation where the participation is only possible when there is a level of funding that is available from the representative. That already excludes those that cannot afford to partly fund their activities. Within that grant, we then employ a number of people, about 120 employees, that are servicing our standards development. We produce about 400 standards a year, and we have a library of about 6,000 standards that we need to every 3 years review. So it's a sizable country specific activity for the SABS. And it has got an impact on the economy, but it also has an impact on the dynamics between our country and other countries on issues of trade. The standards that are developed on that part are the standards that are then used by regulators to develop regulations. They are used by SANAS to manage their accreditation. They are used by in the MISA. They are used by all other entities that are engaging with issues of standardization. So we are a source of standardization and out of that, a number of regulatory or accreditation activities that happen in the country. And then on the 77% part of our income, traditionally the testing labs have contributed the major income. And that income was halved out of the 2008 legislative change. But embedded in the change, as I said before, was the 1987 and the 1996 policy directive that said these entities have to generate their own income. And that then combined with the removal of the regulator meant that the laboratories have to stand on their own and generate their own income. And as a result of the separation, that particular income dropped to half of the original amount. Now, this is important because what the various policy changes have done is that they've moved what is understood to be scientific and technological input into government programs into a commercial activity. And we still need as a country to say whether that is the position. Because what then the country requires is divorced from what is in practice. And so when there is an engagement about the testing facility from the perspective of servicing the economy, there is an indication that it's seen as a public good. And we see it as a public good. But when it comes to the engagement with the support to maintain that facility, it's not seen as public good. And so there is that contrast, the contrast that needs to be resolved. So when we look at the testing, it's mostly inherited infrastructure. There's a book written in the 70s that shows that infrastructure being developed by government to support growth in the economy. Currently it has more than 400 employees that we continue to maintain, even though the revenue from those laboratories has declined. We believe that it's an important infrastructure for the country, and we continue to try and engage with the need for that infrastructure. Then developed, resuscitated the Design Institute, various committees of portfolio committees of Parliament visited the Design Institute. This is our attempt to assist the SMEs and join hands with the leaders and other developmental agencies to bring technical capabilities to the fore for access by young people and SMEs. We train against standards, and every quality manager, maybe every or 9 out of 10 quality managers in the country and in industry will say that they were trained at the SABS, and we offer that training to ensure that the quality standards are maintained in operations and industry. We are allowed, in terms of our legislation, to sell standards, and the international protocols require that we sell standards, and out of the sale of standards, we subsidize the operations and standards as well. We've grown our certification business to subsidize testing business whilst we're engaging with our testing activities are a public good or not. So we've worked very hard as a team to ensure that we are able to grow other parts of our revenue to support the decline in the testing revenue. One of the difficulties in engaging with evolution in policy and legislation and an old institution is fitting yourself and your programs and your people and your culture into the new and evolved environment. And one of those big changes that has redefined how we do things is the Consumer Protection Act. Because the Consumer Protection Act is very specific about our joint responsibility with the retailers as a standard body or as an approving body to the consumer. When I was reaching out for water and I've spoken about this, the Consumer Protection Act says as a consumer, I have a right to a product that is meeting the standard, that complies with the South African National Standards, the Standards Act, or applicable regulations. I'm the guest of Parliament today, and I would like to drink water that I know complies with the National Standard. I look here, I don't know if this water complies. But I have no choice. I have no choice. I'm thirsty. I have to drink the water. And if I get sick out of drinking this water, I don't know who the company is. It's the Parliament that has given me the water. And I am going to hold the host to account for exposing me to a product that does not show that it meets South African National Standards.
I know in the past we had had a stamp, little logo on these bottles. That was at least 3 years ago, I remember seeing it. But just on that note, how do we ensure that the water we buy from the municipality has got the set stamp on. It's coming out of tap.
And Honourable Chair, I think that's one of the policy challenge in the country, and I speak broadly, and where we have really good policies in the country to drive the economic growth, to protect consumers, to develop young people, to do all the good things that we are all committed to. We struggle with the implementation because the procurement document, whether you're in Treasury, you're in the municipality, you are in state entity, has to comply with that and say, if you're supplying us, what you supply us must comply with the Consumer Protection Act. Otherwise, you are taking the responsibility of the supplier to yourself as the procuring entity because you have not insisted on what the Consumer Protection Act says you must do. That has then put an obligation to us as an approving authority. As we approve products that go into stores, we have to approve the products in line with the South African National Standard or the applicable regulation. Because we're no longer a regulator, we've had to then go and have direct relationships with the regulators. We've recently signed with ICASA. You know, we get a lot of our electronic products from other countries, and they come to South Africa, and they then process within ICASA. We needed to then put in place a proper quality assurance process to ensure that as an entity playing a part in that approval process, we can go to court and say that a product was tested or be able to engage with the processes that were followed to approve that product. We are also working with the Department of Health to get to the same arrangement, Department of Mineral Resources for the approval of the pumps that go into the mine. We cannot continue to process those approvals without an agreement between the SABS and them, because we're servicing them, the regulator. We are not a regulator. We have to be empowered by them to do the testing for them. Another issue, honourable members, is that when the country puts regulations and passes regulations are law. It's compulsory for the companies to comply with them. But if there isn't an infrastructure, going back to the testing infrastructure, if there isn't a testing infrastructure dedicated to support those regulators, then we are regulating, but there is no way a company can meet our regulations because there is not an infrastructure on the ground. No one in our legislation or any legislation does the same. SABS maintain their testing infrastructure to support regulation. So our government remains then exposed in that 1987 said we must generate our own revenue. 1996 maintained that stance, and in 2008 when the regulator moved away, we then had to continue to generate our own revenue. The founding principles, the founding rationale for establishing that infrastructure in 1970, which was to support government in regulating products and services in the country for the health and safety of our citizens, is removed. So, as we look at then, you know, the performance of the organization and what we've been able to do, I would like the members to then understand and remember that context that I've spoken about. We focus, you know, given the fact that it's an old institution that has had, you know, many changes, we focus over the last few years on the on clean governance within our environment. We've set ourselves ambitious targets, because we have to pay salaries. When the members look at our financials, they will see that we make enough to pay salaries and maintain jobs for the people. And it's a responsibility that I'm very happy to carry. I would never want to find myself in a situation where I'm not making enough arguments in these platforms to ensure that people remain employed. As a primary responsibility, I have to make sure that the indicators of the SAES, including the people that are employed, don't decline under my watch. We've met 82% of our performance indicators, and all of our targets in assisting entrepreneurs and small businesses and cooperatives were met and exceeded. We were recognized by the Enel company as an organization that has excellence in the way that it executes against its progress. And we worked very hard last year, the members probably saw in the papers some of the issues about the legislation and alignment to the legislation, and I just tried to give the context of that. We were once the first entities in the DCI family, one of the two entities in the DCI family that was given a Green Audit Award by Auditor General 4 years ago. I'm proud to say we maintain that clean audit, and this is the fourth consecutive year where we're reporting on a clean audit. And this team with me is relatively new. The CFO joined us last year, and she worked very hard to ensure that we get that clean audit. The Blackies next to me has been brought in from industry to come and assist us with our automation agenda, transformation agenda. We want to see ourselves in a situation where our services are accessible anywhere in the country, and the interactions can happen anywhere in the world. So our total revenue was 816 million. A 3.8% growth year on year. Revenue from services was 545 million, and total expenses were 819 million, and employee benefits over 500 million. And we also have assisted by our board, a program where we manage prudently our investment, and we are subsidizing some of our operation using investment income, which was about 25 million, to then result in the net profit that you see of 22.4 million. Some of the challenges in trying to balance the various unfunded mandates was the slower uptake of local content verification. At this point, I really would like to extend a thanks to the Honourable Chairperson and the members, Honourable members of this committee, for taking the issue of local content verification and the policy of local content to heart, and holding all of us along the value chain to account for that one policy. It's exemplary, and it is encouraging to see the amount of time that this committee and the honourable members spent on this issue. Our grant, we say that this with the deepened spending of the fiscal constraints that our country is in, but that's the reality, that our grant has been cut. We continue to try and grow the revenue from services in order for us to meet some of the priorities for our government that we have as part of our mandate. The high employee costs, also from the previous entity's engagement, introduction of additional benefits. At the SABS, we then limited that introduction only to the bargaining council, not for management. But the impact is still, you know, very high of the introduction of those benefits. The benefits have been now for the past 4 years, especially the last 2 years, we've seen an increase in our cost base to based on those benefits. Honourable Chair, I will then hand over to Mr. Plaatje to take the members through the objectives that we've set for ourselves. The CFO is here. She will be engaged with the financials after the honourable members have had an opportunity to ask questions. She gave the summary, but she is here to engage with the details should that be needed.
Thank you. I see too many on here. Dr. Mishra Makuru. Right, it's now Mr. Plaatje.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I'm going to take you through the key performance indicators that were reported in the annual report, but this is also as per the business plan of 2013/16. The financials, the first two has already been touched on, so I'm not going to deal with that. The third one on that slide is the implementation of the standards roadmap. We set ourselves a target of 25%, and we achieved that target. The number of certifications issued during against a scheme, we set ourselves a target of 3, and we achieved that. On the customer centricity side, we set ourselves a target of 95%, and we achieved 97%. We shot the lights up in terms of SMMEs, and I think it's important to note that this is self-funded. This doesn't come from core funding. So we had a target of 50, and we achieved an actual of 120. On the productivity side, we achieved a target of 100%, an actual of 100% against a target of 100 in terms of our accreditation. And in terms of the percentage implementation of technology solutions in certification, we set ourselves a target of 20% and achieved 30%. I need to just maybe stress that this is part of our first part of our digitalization strategy and automation of this career, and we are ahead of target, both in that financial year and current as well. On the next, around employees, on the very first one, the Knowledge Hub, we set ourselves a target of 25% and we achieved that target. On the implementation of academic engagement plan, we set ourselves a target of 40% and achieved that as well. The target that we have not achieved is around the culture for customer centricity. And maybe let me just spend a bit more time on this one. You'll see we've given ourselves a zero there, which in actual fact is not really true. If we were to look at the work that we have done, we'd probably come out with a figure of about 80%. That's what we have quantified. However, in our own maintenance of clean auditing, a lot of this work was done not against a detailed signed-off action plan. And so while the work was done, we did not give ourselves credit for that. And even on our scorecard, we did not do that. So we're very harsh with ourselves. Moving on to the first quarter of this year. And the salient points over there is the findings from RVA, and RVA is an international accreditation body that highlighted when they did an audit in our environment that we have grown substantially and our business does not, our methods does not support our business anymore. We were very much a manual-driven business. And based on that, and it was a very detailed set of findings that they've given us, that was input into our strategy for changing the environment. And so our business enablement or our business transformation strategy is enabled through technology and certainly data as well. We have a huge customer centricity focus. This year we did our own internal online customer satisfaction survey, and we achieved just below 70% as well for that. We are busy with the final stages of wage negotiation, and our objective is obviously to strike a balance, no pun intended there, between job security and the union demands. We do go to the CCMA next week on that issue. Moving on to the indicators, the very first one, and you see that I'll make a blanket statement. For all of our indicators for quarter one, it doesn't look a good picture. However, most of them are a timing issue and not necessarily any problems or red flags in the environment. The salient reasons for this one is the reduction in the grants, which you have heard of, last year 45 million, this year 68 million, and then the slow uptake of local content verification. We are still committed to coming in the numbers that we have committed in the business plan. On the operating profit, for the same two reasons above, and then just as our CEO has explained, high stock costs that have come through with additional benefits in previous years. On the third one, the number of products and services developed, we set ourselves, we haven't achieved anything yet, but it's the only one that we are on track before on that indicators. If we move on to the customer centricity one, the number of sector-specific publications, this is not a major issue around this. Set ourselves a target of one. It's just a slight timing delay, and we're reassessing what we want to be doing as well, and a couple more will come through in Q2 and going forward as well. Once again, on the SMME side, we have achieved a 5 against a target of 0, so we're slightly ahead of that key performance indicator. If I move to the next, and this slide isn't very nice, and the very first one, the number of service lines that we're going to be automating, this is part of the early part that I mentioned, our digitalization strategy. And we're actually slightly ahead of our target over there. Although we set ourselves a target of only one, by Q2 I'd be reporting that we would have achieved 2 for the end of this financial year. On moving on to the next, progress against the implementation of the SAB's property strategy. That we've changed our focus slightly there, and that's the only reason why we haven't signed off on that. But that work is now being finalized, and we do have additional people that will be coming into our building. We roughly get about 2% revenue through rental. Progress against the implementation of standard action plan. Subsequent to the completion of this report, we have signed that off now as well. On the last one, progress against the implementation of the testing action plan. We have had a special board meeting 2 weeks ago to do a deep dive around the gaps within testing. As you know, the testing business is a very important part of our business, and we do have a detailed action plan that we're busy finalizing right now. On the employment or employee side of things, the number of technical employees that have completed specialized training, once again, this is in the process of being closing out, and we're finalizing that now. The plans have been finalized, and that will come to green pretty soon. And on the last one over there, we are in the recruitment process, and that will turn to green pretty soon as well. Madam Chair and honorable members, I hand it back to you for time for questions.
Thank you very much. We've just been informed of a time constraint due to a magic sort of chair meeting taking place here. We need to leave here at 2:15. So on that note, I want to first of all thank the CEO, Dr. Michelle Makulu, and your staff for being here. And I'm sure, as I understand it, the CFO is also open to answer certain questions. But you may, I know that time is against you, Ms. Gulf, but if we can just see by show of hands, your questions and that will be 2 minutes. Honourable Easterhaven, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Williams, Honourable Impongi. Thank you. Honourable Easterhaven.
Thank you, Chair, for the presentation. For me, the presentation is not very complete. We say that so many people or employees have been...
Honourable Easterhaven, I mentioned before, it's difficult to hear you. Just talk into the mic.
And as the presentation knew that I would be coming to do a presentation in Parliament, they could have said the numbers that were done up to now. Also, there's a lot of companies in South Africa, maybe that that claim that they that or display the SABS mark of approval without actually passing the SABS protocols. And that happened, and there's a lot of financial implication, I would say, for that. And there's also companies that claims that SABS failed to perform in their mandate and met not meet its obligation, like the plastic pipe industry, which has had tremendous problems with the SABS, even court cases, if I'm not mistaken. And that also affects the industry, industry of in that sector going forward. The SABS is actually assist manufacturers and not blocks, like in this specific case, block the going forward of the processes. Maybe this shows that the SABS facilities is maybe not or inadequate or even have financial implications for them if they not allow people like the plastic pipe industry to do some partial testing in their own right, which would actually assist them. Why do you people block them from doing that? That is
thank you, Honourable Easterhaven. Honourable McPherson.
Thank you very much. In our discussions about local content verification, one of the issues that came up during the colloquium was the capacity constraints of the SAVs to do the testing that was required. Is that, in your opinion, correct? And then, secondly, in your opinion, taking into consideration the debate around global content verification, do you believe that it would be in the country's interests and in the interests of verification to be able to outsource that task to accredited verification agencies outside of South Africa or inside of South Africa that meet your standards?
Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. Ms. Angela, thank you for your presentation. And I think that we should give credit where credit is due. And I think that you've done very well to have a clean audit for the fourth year in a row. And all I'd like to say is keep up the good work. Thank you.
Honourable Mkongi.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have just a few questions. How many standards you developed during the financial year under review? And then how many of those who were existing you have reviewed so far? Second issue, is that how many tests you did during the period of the review? In that context, which products do you find continued default and non-compliance? In terms of local content verification, what are the challenges with regard to local content verification that you want maybe the committee to intervene on? This one is general. I don't know whether someone asked it before, but I'm just concerned, CEO. We got this thing, our relationship with Lesotho goes back to 1983, but 1950.
the Highlands Water Project. Is the South African Bureau of Standards involved in that thing? The dams, the water that we drink that from the Sotho and so forth, is relating to the bottles that talk about. You know, so how do you look at that?
Right. Thank you, Honorable Mkongi. Honorable Mantash.
Very Chairperson, I have one question, because I also concur with Honorable Williams that credit has to be given when it's waived, looking at the performance of the entity. But I just want to know whether the highlight that was made that you have been given a reduced grant, is it a prayer for additional funds? While you have come up front that there's a CSAS contraction in the country as a whole. And in your view, who has to pay for the work that you do on any items that you have to approve under the constraint of CSAS? In your view, is it yourself or those people with products that have to be tested?
Thank you very much, Honorable Mantash. Over to yourself, Dr. Meshula Kulu, and your team. You have got 10 minutes, please.
Thank you, Honorable members. I'm going to address some of the questions and then hand over to my colleagues. And the specific questions on the numbers, I'm going to request through you, Honorable Chair, that we give a written response on the numbers. I'll address it, but we'll give a written response then. The SABS mark issue, there's been abuse of the SABS mark where a company would just affix the mark, and when that has happened, we then have an obligation to follow through and send letter to the company to ask the company to stop using the mark. The company continues to use the mark and gain unfair advantage in the market, and we also have an obligation to then ensure that we take that company to court. We've done that for a few companies, and we've had one success last year or this current year, where the company has to pay a certain amount because they've abused the mark. Now, when it comes to companies not being able to access the market, it's a long story, but I'm going to really try and make it brief. Under the 1993 legislation, which was a regulatory SABS legislation, SABS could do a partial test, which means SABS could make economic contributions and act expediently and give a mark. There were powers and protection that was given to the SABS under the 1993 legislation to enable the SABS to trade. The 2008 legislation removed those powers to the regulator, as it should have, and left the SABS mark as a mark of full compliance in line with this. So it removed the expediency, the powers that protected SABS when you act expediently to support the country and the economy, and all we operate under are the rules of the SABS. And the rules of the SABS say, of the mark, we will go to the factory and sample independently so that we are not giving a mark access to the market on a golden sample. We will test that sample fully as independently. We can subcontract. The rules allow us to subcontract. So there is nothing that says we can't work with industry to subcontract. Actually, our engagement with industry has been there to assist us to find legs that we can use, accreditations that we can use to subcontract in the country so that we can maintain the home. But it will be the deletion of duty on my part
if I gave an SABS mark and I come here and I insist that you use an SABS mark to procure, and I give it expediently depending on who is asking and what are the circumstances in the lab, if the lab cannot do the work. And that's the reality. And together with industry, we've been then trying to work with them to cover those things. Why do gaps exist in the lab? 1987, a policy, an invention, a narrative that said these laboratories must make their own money. So the investment into the upkeep of this infrastructure was unlimited. 1996 confirmed that reality. And so if you've had 30 years of limited investment, because this was not seen as public good, you are going to have legs that have half the capability that's needed in order for it to give a mark. And when the 2008 legislation then removed the power, we are left with full testing protocols to work with. And against those, there are just tests we can't do. Unless this government then comes and stays in the policy, here is the project, you can do it because, you know, it's expedient, it's needed by the country. Without those powers and rights, it's going to be difficult for anyone to operate outside of their legislation and the number of legislations that influence our environment. So there is an expectation gap there in that the country expects the SABS to continue to operate as we operated in line with the 1993 Act. And the 2008 says you can't operate in that way. And so the alignment between what is expected and needed by the country, because I'm not saying it's only expected, I'm also saying some of it is needed. The policy development and evolution might have missed what is needed by the country. And that's the acknowledgement that I'm putting it to the committee that we've missed those policy implications as we evolve the legislation. Then there's an issue of the SABS self-trust. I would like to, when somebody says SABS, for everyone to have the sense of comfort that this is an entity that has integrity, hence the clean governance stance that we've taken for ourselves. That when I sit here, I insist that it would procure in line with the SABS, that you trust what's behind the scenes, that you don't doubt our processes, these issues of expedience that some company is going to get in mind, that is not even in your mind. And that is the philosophy that we're working with. And so if the infrastructure does not support that philosophy, we are not going to take. We are going to then work hard with our board to make a business case to invest in that laboratory so that we can do things right. Or subcontract with our partners to make sure that we can maintain this trust and integrity system. Then, the issues of the numbers. So we used to develop a number, 450 standards a year. And we used to then have an agenda to update them every 3 years. We moved away from that because what then happened was our people started to bring standards that were not relevant. They would chase a number and we'll find that only 10% of those standards have utility for the cash. But we were just aligning with the world and chasing a number. So we moved away from that and we started to work with our colleagues at the DTI to develop standards, local standards that were supporting ICANN. And against that mandate, we then started to reduce the numbers. Last year, the previous year, we were working on 120 local standards that support the country. Members will remember the issue of...
I just have to remind you, you've got a minute left.
Okay, maybe I should... And because I was going to talk about the issue of addresses at Logwe and the role the South African Bureau of Standards played in updating the standard, which is an international standard, to be able to talk to informal settlements and assisting our government to be able to manage their processes with the uniqueness of this country that has informal settlements. Can I hand over to Mr. Plachin to address that?
I'd like to indicate is we are going to put the questions to you in writing to respond, because I don't think 30 seconds you will be able to do justice, will you?
I think let me just do a clarification in 30 seconds. I think it's very important. Honourable Esteban said that we are blocking the industry. That isn't quite the case. This is a voluntary testing. The industry can go to any other test house to do the test if they want a partial test. We say we test fully. So we're not blocking anybody. We've also met with the pipe industry, and we've actually resolved their issues with having agreements with overseas laboratories that we partially both they and ourselves are carrying costs while we upgrade our own facilities as well.
I'd like to thank you, and I know when we're doing our oversight again, we will try and take account of you there, because your work is good. I'd like to thank all of you, Dr. Michelle McCool, CEO, Ms. B. Masakos, Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Plyke, Corporate Services Executive, and at the back there, DTI, Ms. Dr. Damana. Thank you all for being here. I am going to request that you take your empty bottles and just put them at the back of the on the table over there and cups. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned until Friday, 8:30. 119. Thank you.